Hello and welcome to episode 93 of The Crate and Crowbar. It's the 19th of May 2015 when we're recording this. And 93, as it turns out, is a pretty auspicious number because 93 was the number of episodes we did of the podcast that preceded this one. So with this one, we've now matched ourselves. I checked that today. We've now, as of next week, we will have done more Crate and Crowbar than we did of the other podcast.
We're allowed to say its name. It's not Voldemort.
Yeah, I don't know why we've always avoided
saying I thought we were talking about the Voldemort podcast.
They're on that, of course. Many hundreds of
episodes. Given how close we came to calling this podcast, what Marsh put in the document, Hitler was right? Yeah, there you go. That one's one we couldn't name. No, the PC Gamer podcast. So yeah, so the PC Gamer podcast that died before cracking open like an egg or an X-Man to regenerate into this...
Pod.
Yeah, or pod, indeed, into this podcast. We've now almost matched it and exceeded it.
In much, much less time, I would say.
Yeah, well, it turns out when you don't do a podcast every week to X amount of time, it happens, the number goes up a lot faster. The other reason 93 is a significant number this week, sort of, is because 1993 was when Doom came out. And that's a segue into briefly talking about Doom, why not? Because we saw literally 2.5 seconds of it this week.
Big skeleton man with guns on his shoulders.
Yeah.
What are they called? The Doom 2 enemies.
They are Doom 2 enemies. It was a Doom 2 gun as well.
Voldemort, I think.
Voldemort
just swarming in.
Rocket Voldemort. And the two shotgun. The
Rocket Voldemort and the two shotgun. Classic Doom.
I thought it was interesting given that, you know, there's so much iconography in Doom and they could actually almost do an effective trailer in 2 seconds, I thought. Like, it actually narrowed down pretty much what that game is.
Yeah, that's what that game is about. Yeah. Skeletons going bang!
Bang!
and loading shotguns.
I don't know what children's books you had as a kid. Cow goes moo, skeleton goes bang!
It's got a shotgun, it's got a skeleton, it's kind of red.
Yeah.
Job done. Surely it's just, that's everything that Doom is really, like, as far as aesthetic.
Well, it sort of, because it drifted into being a survival horror, immersive adventure thing.
Half-Life inspired.
Yeah.
You know, like Doom 3 has that kind of, opening 45 minutes where you're walking around a research base and the scientists thing before the portal was open. And I hope they don't do any of that this time. I hope it's, bullet hell shmup in first person, like the
original. Did you get as far as the crate crane puzzle?
Yes.
Where you have to operate a crane, pick up all those crates, and it's just, as I was playing that, it was like Doom 3's Half-Life 2 rivalry was intense, because I think, like, Doom 3 came out first, but I think I was playing it at a time when Half-Life 2 was already out, and I played it. And I was thinking about, like, crate puzzles in the two games. This one, painstakingly move a very slow robotic arm, like left and right, like a sort of, like a toy picking puzzle at an arcade, to pick up crates and then painstakingly move them to exactly the right location. And then flashing back to Half-Life 2 where you pick up those cargo containers with a massive magnetic crane, swing it around, like smash people off the harbour and throw it at things. Yeah, I missed that game.
I think, didn't they do a Doom 3 expansion, which basically added a very limited gravity gun?
Very slowly pick up a saw blade, no, the zombie.
Yeah, it was weird, because it was like, it was worse than Half-Life 2's gravity gun, and also so lame creatively to just sort of say, oh, we could do that, we could have that too. but at the same time, it made the game way better, because gravity guns are just cool.
Did you not see the leaked footage of what Doom 4 was back in 2012?
Yeah, when it was Gears of War.
When it was a Metro.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, a little bit Metro as well.
Yeah, it's kind of really gritty, post-apocalyptic, kind of Rage-inspired.
Urban setting, with kind of freedom fighters, buildings.
A gritty post-apocalyptic.
Oh, no, yeah. Never, ever.
It looks like it's, you know, years after Doom, where as the Lost World is to the original Jurassic Park, so this was like the mutants have spread out over the planet now.
It's not a desirable thing, is it? Really,
Caco demons moving in herds.
I mean, it all kind of seems like they were just looking at Half-Life 2 and going,
Sure.
Well, the first game research base aliens attack, second game out in the full world. Now I get it.
But it also looks like every other, as you say, Gears of War, it looks like Metro. It looks like what they've shown of the new Homefront so far. Like, there's a there's a subgenre of linear, you know, meet up with ragtag band of rebels, shoot at man's go-to-big-thing that's firing a laser into the sky games, which is a whole genre, pretty much, that it was just one of them, apparently. I can totally get why they probably act it, because I imagine the development of that game spanned over into the time when everyone, you know, shrugged their shoulders at that entire concept.
Yeah.
It feels like there's been a little revival of, over the last few years, of just shooters, mostly indie stuff.
Yeah, there's lots of procedural kind of, like, terror of
guns. Yeah.
Strafe.
What's
Strife?
Yeah,
Strafe.
There are a few of them.
Yeah. Strafe.
And even, like, Serious Sam, like, the revival of Serious Sam was just a big revival of that whole idea. And it feels like I'd totally play a big-budget version of that game with bigger kind of bangs and whistles in, and I'd be totally up for just shooting shitloads of demons and big shotgun.
Yeah.
So this Doom is not the Doom 4 that leaked footage was shown of, but
it's been redeveloped since then.
Is it another stab at Doom 4, or is it just going to be a Doom remake? Because it's just called Doom, isn't it?
Just called Doom, yeah.
But the things they've shown are from Doom 2. So I think it's probably just a Doom. You know, like your collective memories of Doom mashed together into a game that's a lot like Doom, presumably.
If anyone doesn't know, there's a pretty healthy community around the original Doom and around making new maps for it today and playing those new maps, and people are doing bizarre sort of narrative stuff with it. There's like, I watched a playthrough of one where you're like, I can't remember if you're like an FBI agent or whether you don't know who you are, but a plane has just crashed and all the survivors of the plane are like some bandits have come into the plane wreckage, and the person doing the Let's Play, I forget who it was, is explaining all this plot, but I'm looking at the level and just, I don't see it yet. Oh, is that bit the plane? but it's also just like, apparently really surreal and bizarre, and she is analysing like this guy's, the individual mappers who made the different maps in the sequence, because it's kind of a mini campaign, and their individual styles and what she likes about their use of space, and something about the limitations of that engine causes people to make really interesting, weird spaces with it.
There's we cover quite a lot of these on RPS, because our news editor, Alice O'Connor, is really into Doom in the mod scene. So recent ones have included a mod which replaced all of Doom's sounds with mouth sounds. So, like, people doing chainsaw noises and shotgun noises. That was really good.
Yeah.
One which added a selfie stick, so you could go around and take photos of yourself, which is great.
That was really cool in theory and looked hilarious, except that it doesn't work the right way when you have to look at an enemy, then you point the selfie stick, and then you get a photo of the enemy with you in the frame, which doesn't make any sense because you're showing behind you, right?
Presumably you turn around when you...
Well, I guess it's like... Doom all sprites face towards the camera. Like, if you hold up a selfie stick in any direction,
they'll always face it. Yeah. Yeah. They can't resist being photographed. They have to spin and like pose towards the camera.
The other one is, I think it's got, is it Brittle Doom? Just been
in
production for years and just adds shitloads of extra gore and extra animations to all the enemies. So when you shoot them, they fall to their knees and blood's pouring out, and you can perform like certain kinds of fatalities basically on them and finishing moves and stuff. And it's kind of disgusting, but then at the same time, amps up the feeling of satisfaction from using its shotgun and that sort of stuff. It kind of
looks really good.
Fits that game really well.
As like third person melee takedowns and stuff and like curb stomp animations. Yeah. It's funny in a way because it's like, because like Doom was all about being ahead of its time, right? Like that was kind of, you know, looking like a game from the future. And this modding effort is basically devoted to adding features from like 2004 to that game. Yeah. Like not like still the future, but like taking the ideas that people bolted onto the first person shooter in the noughties and saying, wouldn't that have been rad if it was 1993? And it would have been mind blowing if that happened. In 2004, it happened in 1992. Amazing, you know, like incredible.
What games do you think, like, if you send a game back in time to yourself in 1998 or 1996, or 1993, I guess, would be the appropriate time, what game would you send to, like, completely blow your younger self's mind?
Mass Effect.
Mass Effect would blow my mind. Any sort of open world thing, like a properly 3D open world, like, with the most sumptuous example of that, you could never imagine that happening.
GTA 5, I can't remember when the original GTA was, but when I first heard of it, I did not believe that it was possible. Like, the idea of
the 2D one.
Yeah, the 2D one. Even the 2D one. Just the fact that it's a giant city, but it's all in a single level. You can't have a level that's that big. Yeah, you can't have, like, cars and pedestrians and buildings and stuff.
The demo for that. The demo for that was, I think, basically the full game, but you're time limited to, like, 5 minutes. Mm. And then after that, you just restart. So you can't be playing the demo, but you just got restarted. And I guess the full game wasn't out, or we didn't have it. And me and my friend Johnny, I think, was around. And we would play that. And every time the time limit was up, we had to switch seats so that the other person could have a go. And it was just, like, the most ridiculous joy ever. I just couldn't believe this thing existed. And that was just so incredible. And, like, the fact that you only got 5 minutes with it made it all the more kind of tantalizing and exciting. It made it feel like there was so much more to...
It's interesting because, like, I think it's bizarrely that exact thing with that timed demo. But, like, GTA is a really good choice because I think I remember being a kid playing GTA 2, maybe, like one of the early 2D GTAs, maybe GTA London, and thinking, one day there's going to be a game like this, but 3D, and it'll look really realistic, and you'll be able to go in the buildings. That was always the thing that would get me, like, going in the buildings and not just being a texture on a cube.
But you still can't really. Most of them.
Far more than you could. Yeah. And I think showing myself GTA 5 would be this moment of, oh god, that is actually going to happen. This one thing that I've idly daydreamed about the future is going to be real. Therefore, everything else I idly daydream about the future is going to be real.
I was thinking this idea sprung into my mind while I was playing Arkham City, which I won't talk about in any depth again because I rambled about it last time, but that something about the animation of that game is just so light years ahead of anything video games could do at that time that I think I would just be unable to believe that it was simulated. Where are the actors? How did you get so many tiny actors inside my computer?
Given my reaction at GDC to using the Vive and what a kind of awe-inspiring experience that is, I do wonder if, you know, would I just pass out? Like, if I gave that to myself in 1993, like, could my brain comprehend that?
Because I was nearly passing out at things that were out in 1993. Like, the first time I saw Doom on a 486, it was like, what? This is blowing my mind. Because it was the first time I expanded the screen to more than 50% of the actual screen size. You know, like, when things didn't run well, you couldn't reduce the resolution. You just had to shrink the screen physically, so there was just a massive green border around it.
Man. What were we talking about?
Doom.
Yeah. It's interesting that, weirdly, this conversation about Star Wars on a video recently, but, like, Star Wars like Doom, like, well, Doom like Star Wars, is something that's completely defined by having made people go, whoa, I didn't know you could make something that looked like that at the time when it was released. And, you know, all of Doom's design ideas, pretty much, like, you know, to the extent that it was kind of supposed to be a horror game in some ways, you know, it was supposed to be a relatively immersive horror experience for a game of that time. But what it's remembered for is being this, you know, lightning fast shooter, like arcade blasting game, because partly it was all about how fast can it go? How much can you get out of this? It was, you know, it was a piece of engineering as well as a, you know, creative experience. They could have made it slow and ponderous, but no, it's about that pace and about that, you know, that kind of sense of momentum, which is something I argue that it shares with Star Wars. And this is maybe a bit of a strained example, but like making Doom 3, like trying to like adopt all the things people have learned since and bolt the new narrative thrust onto it, wasn't the right thing to do. People are now going and just remaking the old thing again, which is completely anathemic to the spirit of the original thing, really. Like, to make Doom now, according to the spirit of the original, it would have to be the most absurd technological, you know, technologically ambitious, you've never seen anything like this thing. It would be a VR deal. Probably why Carmack is now making VR, is because, you know, that's the same creative drive that drove Doom in the first place. But what people actually want, as with Star Wars, is kind of what the thing that's a bit like I remember from what when I was a kid, please. It's kind of an interesting, like, version of expectation.
Like, Rage has its positive points, but there was no one that was thrilled by the mega textures in the same way as they would have been in 1993 by playing Doom and it being in first person or being that fast. And
And like, yeah, there's no comparable technology to that shift to 3D. There hasn't been, so people said that about VR, that, you know, no matter how good a texture is, it's still such a good texture. Like, the precedent exists in your brain for textures to get better over time. That's happened to you in increments. You've been inoculated against it by every other game. It's not like, holy shit, this is real, which is what people thought this would do.
People are idiots.
Yep. Okay.
Hello.
What have you played on the computer?
I've been playing a turn-based tactical RPG called Highlands, which was kickstarted in September of last year, I think, and came out on Steam a couple of weeks ago, which no one has noticed.
No, I've never heard of it.
And I noticed it because it looks really pretty. It's set on floating sky islands, with kind of European architecture of towns on top of them, and like wooden taverns and windmills and grass and blue sky and clouds in the background, and it's really lovely. And it's got kind of all its characters are drawn in a sort of Disney / Banner Saga style way, 2D art, very little animation, and it's basically a bit like Fire Emblem, and all the things that are good about it, the kind of charm of it, are the same things as Fire Emblem. It's that it looks really lovely, it's a really nice place to spend some time, the combat mechanics are quite simple and easily grokked and understood, and there is a scripted plot, so like each of your unit is a specific character, and the storyline is that you are the royal family of this floating island kingdom when it becomes attacked by these kind of robot spider bots, but someone you don't know. And in the introductory tutorial, your father is killed, and then you're controlling the three kids and the mum as you fight to take back this kingdom. And there's like little scripted bits in between missions where they're talking to each other, and you can make, there's, random events that come as you capture a bit of territory, you encounter someone and you'll get to make a choice and that kind of stuff. And it's, in terms of the mechanics of it, you're just dragging your units to a segment of this land. And any time you share an area at the end of a turn with an enemy, then it goes to a combat screen and there's no positioning or anything like that. In each round of combat, all of your units attack at the same time. The maths of it are really simple and really clear. Like, everyone's got an attack score, which is also their health. And you select one of your units to receive all of the damage of your opponent's attack turn. And so, like, the daughter of the family is essentially your tank. Like, she's the main kind of combat character. She's the strongest. And so you just funnel all the damage towards her constantly. And it's beautiful. So, like, there's not much animation to it. It's, like, the characters don't animate it. They're just static images that come up during little cutscenes. But there's just little details to the artwork, like the way that grass shimmers on the wind, or the turning of windmills, or when you end a turn, the passing of time is illustrated by the kind of background of clouds suddenly speeding up and wishing past, and that's really beautiful. And there's not a lot of games like this on PC. Like, we've talked before about there not being much that's like Fire Emblem on PC, but there's also just not many turn-based tactics games which are accessible in this way. Like, most of the time if someone asks for a recommendation along that line, I would say Unity of Command, which is really simple and easy to get into and brilliant, but it's also about the Eastern Front during World War II, and it's kind of muddy brown and grey, and it's about maintaining supply lines and actually deploying actual troop tactics in order to, you know, cut off your enemy's supply lines and that sort of thing. Whereas this doesn't have that. It's just you drag your units about, and then so, like, the son of the family is a mechanic, and you can use them to fortify certain bits of territory in order to give you defensive bonuses. And the mother and the littlest kid are good healers, and so they're healing your family. And as you go along, you get bonus items that you can then use in combat to give you extra attacks. So it's really accessible. The problem with it is that it's much like Unity of Command, kind of balls hard, which is a real shame. And I think it's hard. I don't know if it's intentionally difficult. It's got a normal and a hard mode, and I'm playing it on normal, and it's hard. And it feels like it's hard without good reason. And it's, I think it wants to be the kind of game where it's kind of comforting, it's nice to play, it's lovely to look at, good story, and you're just bashing through enemies quite quickly. And it tries to, I think, maybe incentivize that, because it's got a mechanic where every 9 turns, any bit of ground which is still controlled by your enemy becomes automatically reinforced with a new set of enemies. They respawn, basically. And so, on the very first mission, after the kind of tutorial mission, I was quite easily bashing my way through these territories and fortifying things and triggering resource collection things and taking on new units, recruiting them. And then I got to, like, the far edge of the map, because I had to conquer all the territory, and there were, like, 4 bits of ground there that I hadn't yet conquered. And when I cleared the fog of war and saw that, the force there was 3 times as large as my side. And it was simply that I had taken too long in fortifying and gathering resources on my way there. And there isn't enough flexibility or nuance in the mechanics to allow me to really do anything about that. They're just 3 times bigger than I am, there's not much I can do. And this is paired with another problem, which is that although you can recruit new units and they're able to die, your family members can't. If even one of your family members dies, that's it, it's game over, and you can either restart the map from the beginning, or you can load the last autosave. Loading the last autosave, it just saves every turn, so it just takes you back 1 turn again. Yeah. And this creates a situation where you can't even win by attrition, because every 9 turns, they're getting a new unit on every square that they're controlling.
Yeah.
Whereas you're using the tavern to recruit units based on the number of leadership points you've got. And if, like, it's variable based on the mission you're on, what resources you're able to get in terms of leadership points. But, like, on the first mission, I was getting a new unit maybe every 6 turns. Whereas they had 4 bits of land, so they were getting 4 units every 9 turns. The maths of that aren't ever going to go in my favour. And even if I could attack and kill some of them, they would get 1 attack turn, and I would have to, couldn't have that damage go to one of my family members, because that would just undo the turn, basically. So I would have to go to give it to one of the people who I just recruited. They would instantly die.
No wonder people only come out of that pub every 4 times. Yeah.
Basically red shirts who would just come out. I would sacrifice in order to, like, maybe I would take half of the enemy units out by doing that, and then I could withdraw, heal, and attack again. But there was just no way to ever do that, because I was losing forces more than I could ever gain them. And what ended up happening, actually, was after getting all the way to the other side of the map, I just ended up having to retreat and got chased all the way across the map back to the starting thing, at which point I just couldn't get out of, like, the castle I started in, like every other bit of ground. But it's really unsatisfying to want to restart the map at that point. Like, I don't like throwing away, because it's kind of an interesting story. I mean, if nothing else, like, there is a, like, I want to overcome these odds and find a way to outsmart this enemy. I don't want to just not wipe the slate clean and do it quicker the next time. But at this point, I couldn't do it. And so I saved the game and I went to bed and I got up the next morning. And on my very first attempt at fighting out of the castle, I succeeded. Like, just by, I think, restarting the game, maybe gave me a new random number seed. So I just, the combat rolls, because there's a little bit of variation in terms of how much damage you take on each hit, meant that I only got taken down, the daughter only got taken down to 1 health, rather than getting taken down to 0. And at that point, I was able to steamroll across the entire map, capture everything, until I got to those same 4 squares. And now they were 7 times larger than I was. And so at that point, I just restarted the level and I did it the first time. But this problem then persists through later missions, where it's got this mechanic. It feels like a game that should just be relaxing fun, story, beautiful, bashing on through, and it's got this mechanic that kind of encourages that momentum, but then this other, if any of your family members dies, that's game over thing that just kind of ruins it. And I wish that either a family member could die and you could just continue, and maybe there would be consequences for that because you've just lost your tank or whatever, but, or
also a daughter.
And that could be interesting, or just that there would be some way to revive them, or, you know, like, even Fire Emblem, although you can play it with permadeath on, I think is probably better played. I think we've had this discussion on the
back. I play it with permadeath and you don't, which is a...
Yeah. I think it's probably better if you don't have it.
Its plot solution for death is really elegant, actually. Like, in terms of how to handle dynamic death of main characters within a narrative-driven game, where some characters are flagged as this person can die, and some characters can just straight up die and don't appear again.
Mm.
And then there's characters who are genuinely essential to the plot retire.
Hmm.
But yeah. they take a wound that means they can't fight anymore. But they still pop up. They're still with your party, and they still pop up in cutscenes. But you basically. That your punishment for fucking up a battle and getting that character killed is losing them as a game board piece rather than losing them as a plot thing. I think in some cases it actually does affect how they speak in the plot as well, because they, you know, their experience is different from being
can't talk right now. Still lost that arm.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I think that's a really nice way of doing it, because it doesn't feel too cheesy to the player either. It's just like, oh, so.
Makes sense. If you're grievously wounded, you wouldn't be able to join in with fights.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas you can still show up for the political discussion. Because, yeah.
Unless you get politically wounded. There you are, that as well.
Tom Rawls. Lost all my credibility.
That's what happened to Ed Miliband.
That's it, he's politically wounded now.
The grand Fire Emblem game in the Labour Party.
He's sitting in a tavern waiting to be recruited as a red shirt in Graham's army somewhere.
Yeah.
Write a book, launch a comeback.
The thing with Fire Emblem is that you are a person in that game, which... kind of hinders it as well, because you have a named character who's quite powerful in that. And if your named character gets taken out of action, then game over. And that makes no sense. It's an ensemble drama, basically, a fantasy drama. And it makes no sense that you are actually embodied in that world at all. There's no need. You can create a character better.
I quite like that you are, in a way, because...
It's not something having you there, but the fact that it kills, like, it deletes your game, it kind of stops the game.
In the permadeath mode, yeah.
I think you lose the game if your guy gets KO'd.
So that he is the only exception, or he or she is the only exception to that then.
Which is like, makes no sense really. So.
But because you end up as the only character that's in every single battle, you end up massively, like, I certainly found that, like, my created avatar in Fire Emblem was so much more powerful than the rest of my army, like, I would stick him on other units that needed a boost, because it was just, like, because the unkillable warrior mage towards the end of that game.
Yeah. My Crom was invincible by the end.
Yeah.
It was just everyone was rubbish except him. Like, he ate all the experience because he killed everyone early in the game, so he's like this monster. Everyone else is just pure fodder to, you know, stand in the way of ranged units.
What's the name of the kid that's got a pot on his head?
Oh, the really scared Donald. One. The invisible one. Oh, no, don't you rescue him in an early mission?
You rescue him in an early
mission. I failed to rescue him, so I don't
Donald know. Is the invisible one, I think. The guy.
I don't think he's invisible. He's just, he's got a cooking pot on his
head. No, we're not talking, there's two different characters.
Oh, yeah,
there's
there's
the man-at-arms who, no one ever looks at, because he's so boring to look at that he's functionally invisible.
Yeah.
And then there's the kid with the pot on his head who can become this awesome knight if you work on him. But.
Yeah, which I really hate as a mechanic, because it means that I can't not use him in every fight. Like, if he gets hit even once, he just dies. But you know, because that's the case, that, oh, I bet if I just keep using this guy, he's going to be so good.
Yeah.
So I just take him in every fight. Have him hit one guy and then run away and spend the whole rest of the fight over, like, the far corner where everyone else does the fighting, because...
You're basically, like, doing a power leveling service for him.
Basically.
It's funny the anxiety of losing people in that game, because you do have the power to ultimately switch off. I mean, I'm talking about console game periods now, but, like, you do have the, you know, on the anxiety of losing people, like, because you do have the power to switch it off and try it again, like, that conscious decision to, like, no, I'm going to own that outcome... Like, I lost, is it Pan, the rabbit lady, really kick-ass rabbit lady? I lost her in a really, like, dramatic way during a battle to save someone's life. Like, she sort of held the corridor by herself for ages.
Yeah.
And, like, she actually is one of the ones that retires rather than dies outright, I think. But still, it felt like, I'm actually gonna own that. But it was still my decision as the player to own it, even though technically the game sort of spun out. Like, I think if the game was a lot shorter, it would be easier to accept something like that as like how this bit's a long fucking game as well as the one where you can just lose characters permanently. I accidentally killed that black mage everyone recruits. So, yeah,
the other problem with Highlands is that, Like, it's made by a small team. It was kickstarted. I think they asked for, like, low five figures and got it, like, 700 people backed it or something like that. Mm. And on the night when I played it on Steam, according to Steam charts, only two people were playing it. And so I was one of them and one other person in the world was playing this game. And it doesn't deserve that. Like, it's a good game, actually, and I would recommend it. And I think if you're looking for a route into turn-based tactics games, like on PC, there's probably not much that's better than this, and it looks fucking beautiful. But the other side effect of your family dying and that ending the game is that the autosave thing then becomes a problem, because the autosave just undoes that turn. And so what that does is it encourages you to try to gain the random number system, like just going, well, there's, you know, maybe only a 10% chance that I can win this fight, but fuck it, you know.
Ten times later,
and now I'm through. And so death kind of has this terrible consequence that it ends the game, but then it is also simultaneously just meaningless. It's just this weird attritional thing that's, which is, I don't know. Whether those are deliberate choices on their part, whether they wanted to make it a difficult game, or whether maybe it's a really short game, because I haven't completed it yet, so maybe they're covering up for that or something. But in any case,
clearly, your daughter should retire. I'm out of this game. I'm too old for this shit now.
Sorry, Mum. Sorry, sisters and brothers.
And your tank won too many times.
Yeah, he put me in front of them too many times.
I really like all the characters in it. It's like, even the ones that you recruit from the tavern, like, they have no personality, but they've got randomly generated French names, and they all look like Disney.
That's all you need.
They all look like Disney characters. And there's combatants, engineers, academics, and a fourth class, and they, like, the designs for them all look rad, and they're kind of like random body types and heads and hair colors and stuff like that. You cycle through until you get the one you want.
Oh, that's cool.
Really cool women character designs.
You just roll them out there to sort of the damage for your royal family.
Yep, all those tanky daughters.
I'm looking for someone who can die and we can still carry on.
Yeah.
Anyone in this pub want to come outside and die?
Speaking of turn-based strategy games, where there's plenty of tension and drama, but in fact no randomization or random outcomes.
Huh.
Invisible Ink is the game that Tom and I have been obsessively playing.
There is lots of randomization in that game, but there's no dice rolling in terms of...
Yeah, which makes it all the more brutal when you fuck up, inevitably. It's one of the most amazing things about the game.
And actually, as you were describing Highlands, I was sort of checking off the number of different parallels with Invisible Ink, because it does have permadeath. Your agents in that game can permanently die, and you carry on without them. It also has a kind of go-back-one-turn thing, but it's limited, so you only get to use it a certain number of times, and the difficulty mode determines how many times you use it. Anyway, don't go on.
Well, actually, I think you've played way more of it, Tom, but it's the first time I've played it since 76
hours.
The Early Access version. And I think we've talked about it before on the podcast, and identified, like, a few problems with it, like with the way that the levels were generated, the way that it was intensely difficult. And for me, all of that stuff has just been completely fixed in the current version. The level generation is, like, fantastic. Not in the sense that it generates, like, realistic spaces, really, but it generates fantastic self-levels based around that make the mechanics really interesting. So basically, if you haven't heard of Invisible Ink, you're running a spy agency which has just been busted by the corporations that rule the world, and you've got 72 hours to get back on track and strike back, and you take, you've got, like, a world map, and you get to choose your missions. Some of them are, like, heists, you know, rob a bank. Some of them are, okay, here's a technology company, go and rob some technology to improve your agents. Or here's a prison, you can actually rescue a new agent, break them out of the prison, they join your crew.
One of them is a cybernetics facility where you can install augments in your character, and each machine that can do that, there's two of them, can either give you a new org, or if you don't have room for one, then you can have a new slot put in. And the new slot procedure is so invasive that it knocks you out for two turns. So you break into someone's high security facility, use their machine, and then just lie on their floor for 2 minutes. It's like passed out from the procedure.
That's so dramatic. Like, it's so good at generating just awesome, like, heist moments or stealth moments. So, like, I had an agent down who was like, there's a little ZZZ, like, sleeping icon over them. Even though it must have been a presumably quite horrific procedure that they've just undergone to install a neural slot in their brain. But I had two agents on it. There's only one entrance to the room. Got an agent on either side of the doorway in ambush stance, which means that if anyone comes in, they just get zapped. And, sure enough, like, the security level upgraded. And they, sometimes when the security level upgrades, they automatically detect one of your agents, like the ambient scanners in that building will just find one of your agents at random. And then nearby guards will be drawn to them. So they're like, got two guards coming in. One came through the doorway. One of my agents like grabbed them by the neck, like tasered them, they're down. Another one came through. The other agent on the other side of the doorway tases them and they go down. And it was like just a scene from a movie in this, just like randomly generated strategy game.
I had, so actually that ambush thing is kind of, it's called ambush now, it used to be called Melee Overwatch, which is a more gamey term for it, but it explains what it is, which is, that's the kind of centerpiece of the game. You don't have any guns by default, the first two agents you're allowed to play with have no guns at all. In each shop you might get some kind of like tranquilizer dart gun that only has two shots ever, and can't go through any armor and that kind of stuff, but most of the time you're using tasers, and you can't, it's almost, impossible to just run up to a guard and use a taser on him. If they are in a position to see you on their turn, then they will pull a gun on you and you'll be frozen in the spot and you have one action point with which to do something about it. And if that action point doesn't get you completely and permanently out of the line of fire, you're dead. And so it's all about waiting to the side of a doorway in ambush mode with a taser, and when they walk through the door, then you tase them. Or on the edge of a corner, or just behind a chair, or... It's got really good looking levels, and they do have a really clear system of cover. There's no, like, half cover like an XCOM. It's just either there's cover or there's no cover. And it is pretty clear. It's easy to understand. But the relationship between the two doesn't always hold up. Like, there is a sort of 2 meter tall pencil thin lamp stand that just has a light on top of it. It's a light to be clear, self game. That is cover from all sides. You can hide from that. There's a guard like one square away, but there's that lamp between you. No way he can see you. And you can't shoot past it or anything like that. It completely blocks all.
From a corporate security point of view, this seems like a really good advert for open plan offices. like big Silicon Valley campuses where everyone sits on beanbags. Like, that's probably why they exist, actually. They are infiltration proof by necessity of not offering any cover.
My amazing movie moment on my playthrough was I had two agents, International and Decker, and International is a hacker and Decker is kind of a stealth guy, he has a cloaking rig. And they've each got a taser. When you use the taser, it takes 3 turns to cool down, so you can't tase someone next turn or the turn after. And my new toy for International, which I just discovered, I thought it was useless for ages, and then I finally tried one and figured out what it did, and it's fucking amazing. It's a server that you have to put down somewhere in the level, and then once it's down, it generates 1 power per turn. And your normal income rate of power is 1 power per turn, so it doubles your rate of power. This is like a fairly high level one. And so I put it down. I'd never used it before. Realized it was going to generate infinite power for free forever. I was like, holy shit, the only disadvantage is you've got to go back and pick it up before you leave, because otherwise you're leaving it behind. So you don't want to put it in an area that you're not going to come back to. But I found a good area where I knew we were going to come back to it. And then a guard walked past and just picked it up. You're fucking what? Like $1,000 on that? You can't have that. So it's just like flabbergasted and also furious. That motherfucker, like, you don't really kill people in Invisible Ink most of the time. There are lethal weapons in it, but you wouldn't normally do it because there's extra consequences. It raises the alert level higher because they all have heartbeat sensors. And if their heartbeat goes down, then that makes security more tight. But this guy, I was like, I might kill him. I might buy a gun and just shoot him dead. But I couldn't do that. And International was like right next to this guy. And she was, because he was on her way back to pick up the laptop. We're about to leave. The whole mission's done. I just need the laptop back. And they fucking stole it from me. And the guy picked it up. And then I looked, you can kind of predict where the guards are going to go. And so I observed him and it traces out the movement path he's going to take. And he's going to go into this massive room, which is actually where we started. And I could chase after him and tase him. But there's another guy in that room. So there's two people, and it's a huge open area. You can't leave an agent out in the open at the end of their turn, because they will get seen. And she could tase him. And actually, Decker, who has really good speed, could, if he ran, get into that room. He has to run so everyone will hear him. It will blow his cover with a bunch of people he's dealing with. But if he does that, he can reach one of those people. He can reach the closest one to him, and International can reach the other one. But Decker just tased someone, so his taser's on cooldown, and like, fuck, okay, this is so close to being a solution, but it doesn't quite work yet. And then I realized, you can recharge a taser. There's kind of like universal charging units that you can use to either reload a gun or to recharge something that has a cooldown. And I could use one of those on his taser, but he doesn't have it. International has it, and she doesn't need it. Her taser's fine, his taser's on the cooldown. She's in one spot, he's in another spot. They can each reach one guard, but it has to be the same one. And Deckard needs that taser. So I can't, there's no way to do it where you move one of them tase a guy, then move the other one, because Deku will get there without any charge for his taser. But I realized, even though he's sprinting, if I move International to one side of the doorway to that room, then have Deku sprint to the doorway, he can stop at a tile adjacent to her, and she can just pass him the charge pack on his way in as he sprints up to the guy, and then recharge his taser while sprinting, and then get him in the neck just as International takes down the other one, and they both get taken down in perfect sync.
It's so good. I've had, like, that passing mechanic alone is, like, so much of what you do in that game sells this kind of spy thing so, so well. Just even when you're by a doorway, you can press peek to kind of peek and get a look through the keyhole, and you get like a limited vision on what's on the other side of the door. Then, if you want, you can open the door, and that gives you more vision. Then there's like a peek move that lets you go round the door and like get even more vision on the place. And all these degrees have their own risk, but there's this constant sense of being a spy and taking risk rewards decisions. Like every turn is full of these little decisions. Like, I don't have enough action points to peek and properly case this. Am I just going to open it because I need to be really fast because the alarm's coming down? And I've had times where one person's had you can mug guards, and like if you've knocked a guard out, you can steal stuff, and they might have like a security code pass key. So I'll have a thing where my agent, who's really good at hacking, needs to go and hack this terminal in this other place. So she's not going towards the security door, so my agents pass, and like in the fantasy, he just tosses the card to the other guys and goes past with that pass mechanic, and then they just carry on going. And the game constantly creates these moments of drama, and is essentially just an amazing emergent puzzle game because it's all randomized. And all the rules, as we said, like there are no random dice rolls in any of the interactions. So all of the interactions, and you can look at a guard, and if they're in view, you can see exactly where they're going to go. And even with all this certainty, there are still just loads of interesting decisions to constantly make about what you're going to do and how you're going to deal with the situation. And it's always interesting. Like, it's always interesting.
Yeah, it's an amazing level of intel they give you. I think so many, like, turn-based games and stealth games and loads of games that are supposed to be about really deep strategic thought hide intel from you. There's Fog of War in all RTSs. There's percentage chances in XCOM. They're always trying to stop short of telling you everything about the situation because they want you to have to take risks and stuff. And Invisible Ink just doesn't do that. There's not only can you see where a guard's going to go. If you have vision to him, you can kind of observe his movements and tell where he's going to go next turn. But also, even if you can't see, even if you don't know a guard exists, if that guard can see the room you're about to walk into, you can see that he can see it. So everywhere the enemies can see is bright red all the time, and that's completely 100% reliable. You can never walk into an area not knowing that the guard's going to see you, which is madness. Like, that's the mechanic of stealth games. That's how stealth games work, is you might get caught because you didn't realise you were going to get seen. And this is a stealth game where you know 100% for sure whether you're going to get seen or not.
Every decision you make, you own completely, because you're never going to be fucked over by chance. You're never going to be fucked over by, oh, I didn't know you wasn't going to see me there because the interface wasn't clear, because the interface is fucking beautiful. Like, you can press Alt at any point, and even if the world view it gives you isn't enough, pressing Alt just lays naked all of the level geometry.
Yeah, I didn't notice until recently. I haven't tried it yet.
And it's just, okay, well, even if you're not sure, there's no excuse. There's no excuse for not knowing that you weren't in cover at a given point. And it just makes it completely fair. And that makes it, like, it makes it fantastic. The difficulty is so well pitched. The level of challenge is so well pitched.
The last time I played it, and I think I spoke to it about it on the podcast at the time, was before it was added to Steam. And the problem I had with its difficulty specifically was that you would start a mission, and in order to, there's this kind of risk-reward thing where the alarm is going to go up and up. Yeah. But you need to get resources from these missions and then get to the elevator. But you had no sense of where the elevator would be. Like, I had procedurally generated levels where the elevator was almost right where I started, and then others where I would be in the middle of the level and the level would branch off in two or three different directions, and I didn't know to which end the elevator was. And so it felt at that point like this was a game about finding elevators. Like the risk reward wasn't even an issue. It was just, I've got to just find where the elevator is. Nothing else matters. I'll get stuff on the way to the elevator, and if it's close, then maybe I'll have time to scout other areas. But if I don't think about just finding the elevator as soon as possible, then I'm just going to be fucked no matter what. How have they changed that?
Well, you get to a point of confidence with it where that's not how you feel about the level. You're kind of like, oh, I want to get as much as possible if I can, and I'll sense when I'm in danger, and I'll retreat when I am. And obviously, if you haven't found the elevator by then, you need to seriously think about that. But in general, once you're used to all of the mechanics, it's not hard just to get around. If you just want to get to all of the places in the level without doing anything particularly risky, that's easy because you'll have plenty of power to disable the cameras because you're not spending any power hacking safes, or there are databases all over the place that will tell you either where all the cameras are, where all the consoles are, or just a whole map of the facility. And in all three cases, that tells you pretty much where you haven't been. If you don't have a full map, it will say, well, there's three consoles over there, so you know that door leads somewhere. And so you kind of get a sense, if you haven't found the elevator, it's probably over there, all that kind of thing. So I haven't ever had a point where I wanted to retreat and couldn't. I've always found the elevator by the time I wanted to get out of there. And then it becomes a case of, like, how much can I get before I leave?
Mm.
And it also, the difficulty has dramatically changed since the early access version. Because it used to be that the easy mode would give you one rewind, that thing where you can step back one turn. And I think that was it. That was all you got.
I think when I played it, it didn't have rewinds at all.
Yeah, so they added that as easy mode, and then also guard patrols were less aggressive and various things. But in the full version, the experience mode, you get you only get one rewind per level. But easy mode, you get 5 rewinds per level, and also, if you fail the level, you can just redo that level. So, there's no kind of permadeath in terms of your agency. Like, it used to be that if all your agents die, you just screwed up the whole mission. Your entire agency shuts down. Everything you've built over the last 72 hours is completely gone forever, if you're 72 hours in. Whereas in easy mode now, you can just redo that mission. And you can even, if you got into a situation where not only where you fucked on that turn, but also you went into that mission completely fucked and you just had nothing and you're just terrible at the game. You can redo that day, so the last 24 hours, you can kind of step back to that. And yeah, I've heard from, you said it fixed your issues, Tom, and Steve Gaynor had the same thing where he was really put off by it at first because it just seemed punishingly difficult, and he says that the easy mode thing has just completely fixed it all. I was getting to the point where on easy in the early access version, it was almost too easy. I was kind of already chopped grade to hard. I think it was just, or maybe it was just easy and normal. And so when the full thing came out, I've been playing on experienced and I finished the campaign now and I did it on my first try and only one person got knocked down, which is pretty good going, but it felt massively harder than the previous playthrough I'd done. And it was basically just, because it's so absolute, because it is about these certainties, and because there is a way to figure out everything, it didn't, instead of, the increase in difficulty didn't mean I took more casualties and I lost more and only scraped through just barely. I had almost exactly the same performance that I had in the easy mode of the previous version, except it took me about 6 hours longer. So missions, instead of taking 30 minutes, would take me an hour and 40 minutes. And I think my longest was 2 hours. The final mission took me 2 hours to do. And the whole campaign was about 10.5 hours, whereas previously I'd done the campaign in about 6 or 7 hours. And so it was the same number of missions, same kind of amount of space to get through, same kind of objectives, but I just spent that much longer thinking about every turn, because there's just so much more to kind of get your brain around.
It's a really good progression as well between difficulty modes and stuff, because you unlock new agents that you can start with to your agency. You break them out of prison and stuff, but even then, like, you can... So for my intermediate playthrough, I've started with 2 separate agents. So Internationale and Decker are the 2 default ones, and Internationale is particularly fucking amazing. She's got this wireless node that lets her kind of detect terminals in other rooms and suck power out of them, which is super good. But I've like jettisoned her and gone with the 2 new agents. One of them is like a guy who starts with a sniper rifle, which is that super high risk insta-kill thing that can just like set off the entire facility. Mm. And you've got that. You can press that big red button from the very start of the game. And if you're ever in trouble or on like security 6 maximum alert and there are like crazy guards everywhere, then it's the time to like break out the gun and like do the mad rush for the elevator. Like I've had several missions end where everything has just been red. There've been guards everywhere and I've just like stormed the elevator and just like gotten out in the nick of time. And that's sort of stuff you can do with when you're really desperate and not very good at the game.
What's the other one you got?
She's like...
Is it Banks?
Yeah.
She's the psycho. She's
yeah, that's right. She's like yeah, the damage.
Her abilities are weird though. I think she was meant to be the hacker character originally. They kind of changed their mind because the description, even the voiceover says she's like an amazing hacker, but actually Internationale is the amazing hacker.
Yeah,
and the voiceover Internationale says she's a great all rounder, which is weird.
It's like Banks is good because like Internationale is like a big kind of power hose. She like sucks power out of everything. Whereas I think Banks, she gets maybe double power for hacking stuff. I don't know.
She can open any locked door. except for vault doors. So, like, the things you need pass cards for, she doesn't need a pass card for. So not only do you not have to find one, but even after the point where you're normally picking one up, it doesn't take an inventory slot. So she's effectively got a free inventory slot, or she's one movement point faster, which is great. And she's also got just a syringe that she can inject already unconscious people with that keeps them down for longer, which is one of those things that seems like, you know, if they... My stealth brain always wants to eliminate things from the equation. I want to take people out permanently. And, like, even if I'm going to knock them unconscious, I want to put them in a dumpster somewhere so they can't get back out. And Invisible Ink completely defies you on that. It won't let you do it. And so you knock people out, and it's like, well, they're going to come back in 3 turns, and then the thing that makes them come back in, like, 3 more turns, is that really a big deal? But once you start using it, you realize, yeah, that's a really big deal. That is just, you can just relax for once. You can just say, okay, that guy is not going to wake up in a minute. And, so, yeah, if you've got Shalem, the guy with the sniper rifle, Shalem, I think it's actually pronounced, he's basically got a kind of end-game weapon from day one, which is really weird, and it's only, they can only get away with it because of the weird way that, like, resources work in that. Because he has an armor-piercing rifle, and he also has a cybernetic org that lets him, gives him an armor-piercing bonus to any gun he uses, so he has double armor-piercing, so he can penetrate 2 layers of armor, which you're not going to encounter for, like, 6 missions, and when you do, it'll be fucking useful to have this guy around. And if you don't have him, it's really hard to find that kind of equipment. Like, it's really hard to get that ability.
Yeah.
But he just won't need it for, like, 6 missions. So he's got this gun where it's like, yeah, it is useful if you get totally fucked. You can just shoot someone, but you won't want to shoot someone unless you absolutely have to. Hmm. So it's just kind of this dead weight. When I played with him, I was playing with him and Dr. Zhu. Dr. Zhu,
tell me it's animals. Tell me
it's XU.
Oh.
He has a door trap. So you can put a trap on a door where the next person who opens it just gets electrocuted on the spot. We're just playing the first mission together and got to a shop that had so much good stuff that I just had to have it all. It was that stuff I just learned was amazing, and one thing I desperately wanted on my last playthrough that I never got, which is an org that reduces the cooldowns of everything, including a taser, including every single thing that has a cooldown. And it was so good that I made Shalem sell his gun so that we could afford it all. I guess it's like his personal rifle. It's got like a backstory for it. Yeah. Like, oh, mission one. It's like, no, sell it. Yeah. We need the $350 we get for this. And then at the end of the mission, we were on the way to the elevator, and then I found there's another room we hadn't explored, and there was 2 safes in it with masses of money in it. And there was shit, we could have afforded all this stuff. But, so I ran back to the shop because I remember I'd seen a buyback option once. I'm like, can we buy Shalem's gun back? We had to fight our way past like all 5 guards who'd all woken up because we only knocked them out for 3 turns. And get past them all and get... I think Dr. Zhu went there because it was he who actually sold Shalem's rifle. And he felt bad in my fiction. So he had to fight past all the guards and get back there, and then you can't buy it back. So it's just a complete waste of time and a complete waste of his personal weapon.
It's fantastic. It's really so good.
Like, you were talking about passing things off. Just one more story about that.
Oh, yeah.
I had Dr. Zhu and another agent, I think... Might be an international, maybe Banks. And Dr. Zhu had run out into a room thinking he would tase someone, then discovered that guard had armor, which means he can't tase him. So he used up all of his action points, and he's stuck standing right next to a guard who isn't looking at him, but he's going to turn around next turn, and Dr. Zhu's just fucked. There's no way we can save him. Because even once he has him at gunpoint, you get a turn to sort that out, but he's armored, so we just have nothing to take out armor. I didn't have Shayla. So he's standing right next to Banks, and... Banks has action points, she can get away. She can't take the guy out, she can't help him in any way. All she can do is survive. And she's standing right next to him, so I just had Dr. Zhu just give her everything. Just like, here's my door trap, here's my pass card, here's my taser. just take them all.
Take my shit and live.
I already moved, you haven't moved yet. I'm standing here until he kills me.
Oh, man. It's like, I don't know how they could have executed that fantasy better in a turn-based format than... kept all the spy tension and the spy excitement, and it looks absolutely amazing as well. The art's so good.
Yeah.
I would watch a Saturday morning cartoon based on their kind of the style of their intro sequence. It looks so good.
Have you completed it yet?
No, I'm halfway through the intermediate playthrough, and I'm kind of fucked. Determined to beat it. So,
why are you fucked? Have you like run out of money? Or?
I was really ambitious because if I see a prison, I always try to break someone out of it.
Yeah.
Because I want to get the max team size, and it like helps you so much. Like, but you do one prison run and it's fine. But the second prison that it spawns like is a higher security level than all the other things on the map. So I was on like day 2 and it was like a day 3 level security thing, and I had 3 people. But I didn't, of course, like if you find a third person, you have to then outfit them. So you have to, he didn't even have a taser. So I just had this total mook. it was with my two, like, expert agents. And, I was really struggling to get through, like, find that fourth agent. It's a tough mission.
I managed to get four agents on my playthrough, and yeah, I had the same problem where they just had no kit at all. Yeah. They just had nothing. And so they just become, their job is just to sit on people.
Yeah.
Because that timer of people getting back up actually doesn't apply if you stay on them. Mm. So you tase them, they go on the ground, and when you tase them, you kind of pull them to you, and they're on your tile, and you're standing on them. And their timer won't start ticking down until you leave them. And so if you only have two agents, well, you've got to move on anyway, because you've got to get those two agents to the objectives and stuff. But if you have two agents and one guy who's just fucking useless. I think for me it was Banks, actually, the first person I rescued, and she just had nothing, literally nothing. So we would just, like, Decker and International Arrow come in and tase some people, and then Banks would just have to sit on them. Banks, just sit here, and we'll come back.
I got Nika on my first run, and she's an amazing sort of Russian spy who's just... whenever she punches someone, she gets more moves with which to punch other people. But, like, because she gets, like, a great cooldown on her melee abilities. So you could just send in her with a taser and she would just tase the fuck out of everything.
she's the only person who can attack twice on her turn.
Yeah, she fucking can.
In addition to that, her taser has no cooldown, but it costs power, so it drains your hacking resource, which is really scary.
But if you've got international, then it's like...
Yeah, so it's all about like balancing those things.
No, it's so good. Fucking love that game. Yeah, it's so good.
Basically perfect.
Made by Clay, who also did Mark the Ninja. Don't Starve and Mark of the Ninja. Mm. Isn't that like...
And Shank.
Not a bad run.
Isn't that like a better run than almost any other indie studio?
Pretty fucking amazing.
They're amazing because they're so different. Like, just totally different games.
They
talk a bit about things they learnt from Mark the Ninja. They were interviewed by the Three Moves Ahead podcast, which is like a strategy gaming podcast with Rob Zatney and Troy Goodfellow. They talk a lot about I forget which two people they have, but the two key people.
The studio owner and the Jamie Chang.
Yeah, and James Lance, I think. Designer. And it's a really good talk, actually. They talk about things they learned from Mark of the Ninja. But it's interesting because the lead designer of Mark of the Ninja is Nels Anderson, who left after it finished. And so he's off on Firewatch.
They're really good at making the games.
They're also doing Don't Starve Together, which is apparently really good as well. It's the multiplayer version of Don't Starve.
Cool.
Which done as its own game, basically.
Apparently this is the longest a game's ever taken them, and it's been the hardest one to make, and random level generation was basically the main thing. A bitch.
It's pretty impressive.
It's weird though, because geometrically it looks really simple. It's literally just a series of rooms kind of joined together in a slightly irregular fashion. And they're just square rooms, they're not sort of like super complex shapes. And when they do have like a central feature, it's a preset one that you recognize from previous playthroughs. But I guess there's just a massive amount of complexity in what it does to you. Like, I actually did have one level that I think was unusually difficult because it was all on one long line. So after we got to the objective, we had to get all the way back and everyone would just thought I'd woken up and the security level had brought on more guards. So it was just much harder on the way out than it was on the way in.
I think there is a lot of the complexity because whenever they place a block object, that has severe ramifications on where you can take cover or can't take cover.
Yeah, true.
So there's a lot of balancing there that I don't quite know how they've done it. I think it's one of the most impressive random level generation games I've seen, I think.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I interviewed Jamie Chang, I think, before the game was even out, before I played it, and he talked about the challenges of procedural generation when it's a... specifically when it's a stealth game and it's all about what information does the player have and if your procedural generation is too formulaic and the player can make assumptions about, you know, what direction to move in, then that does cut down on a bunch of stuff. And it's interesting.
Hmm.
Tom, what have you been playing?
That a hell of a lot. And actually, I finished it, and it took me 10.5 hours. And I was just so in love with it and so excited by it. And that once you finish, every time you finish a campaign, you unlock a bunch of stuff. And because I had all this previous experience from early access, I completed the game on my first try on the second difficulty level. So you get just a fucking shitload of experience for that. I leveled up like 6 times at the end of it. So I finished the game and then just gave me a list of like 16 different things I unlocked. Here's 2 new power things. Here's 2 new agents. Here's another 2 new agents. Here's another ability. Here's 2 new power things. Here's 2 more agents. I was like, oh god, I gotta play it again right now. try some of the stuff. And particularly, like, two of the agents I locked were a real surprise. They had no idea they were going to be a thing I would get, so it was really exciting. And then I was like, okay, how deep do I want to go on this? Do I really want to just delve straight back into Invisible Ink? And the answer was yes. And then I got my ass kicked on both of my new playthroughs. I played on the old difficulty level, but I just got fucked. I just got too cocky because I was used to being able to handle everything. And early on, if you don't have armor piercing, you're just fucked. So I moved on to Galcid 3.
Another, that was a lighthearted...
another incredibly deep, nerdy, turn-based game that requires massive deliberation. And I've only played the tutorial of it, but the tutorial is very wisely an actual match. It's just a very small match of the game, which still took me about 6 hours to complete. And that was not entirely the tutorial's fault. And I think it's the best way to do a tutorial. It's probably the best tutorial they've done. It's just a match where there's only two other races. One of them's friendly, one of them's hostile. And the other two races have one planet each, and you have one planet, and there are, I think, only two planets that you could possibly take, like, colonize, and they never colonize them, so they just leave them for you. So it's just, like, learn the ropes without any outright aggression. But because it's Galsiv, I got kind of... Brilliantly, they don't lock off anything, so the whole tech tree is available to you. Everything, you can do whatever you like. And I was... doing what they said initially, like using survey ships, learning how to do this and this and that. And like 90% of the game is just exactly the same as Galcif 2. But then the 10% that changed, they've really changed. And it's not just kind of like, let's make it look a bit better and make it a bit nicer. I mean, they have made it look better and nicer, but they haven't... The things they've changed weren't things that they did for the sake of looking modern or kind of feeling like we got some value for money. It's the things they've changed feel like things where they thought, we can just do this better, we can just rip this whole system out. Mm. So things like, you don't decide the taxation level anymore, which used to be a thing I just thought about constantly. It was just always, where do I put the tax? I think I changed the tax level every turn for my entire, like, 6 year playthrough. And now you just don't decide it, because I think they probably decided, I'd really like to hear them talk about this actually, but, my guess is that there's probably just a correct level for it on every turn. It's always just, well, you wanted them to pay as much tax as possible without them rebelling.
Yeah.
Or if you need them to be to increase the population, there's probably a better way to kind of balance that. And I have to say, I don't miss it now that it's gone. And so you, instead of like, used to be this really complex web of sliders where you managed how much tax you want to charge, then how much overall production you want to do of your total production capacity in all areas, research, industrial, all these other things. How much of that you want to actually use, which all that costs money, so you've got to balance that with your taxation. And then within that big slider, three different sliders for how much of your production that you are spending do you want to distribute between research, industrial, and... what's the other one? Research, industrial, and money, I guess. Yeah, something like that. And in the new one, it's just... Do you know, it seemed like a hue wheel in Photoshop, where like kind of different colours are in a circle? It's that, but sort of with a triangular arrangement between research, industrial, and economy. Right. And you just move this one point between those three points on the circle. Hmm. And if you want it to be all split between research and industrial, then you move it to the very edge of the circle away from money. And along that circumference, you can kind of slide it along that curve to how far you want it to be towards research or industrial. And then the only other thing you have to worry about is industrial kind of splits down into ships and planetary improvements, which is another slider. So they haven't quite solved it, like perfectly elegant, but it's pretty elegant. And yeah, the tutorial's basically, it's really straightforward until you get out into the, once you kind of leave your starting area, the Iconians, who are your allies, tell you that, oh, we're lucky, there's only one Drengen world in this area. Drengen are the big bad guys. and there's this amazing, really lush planet, that hasn't been taken by anyone. And, but it's right next to Drengen territory, so we don't want to take it, but if you want to take it, that'd be fine by us. It's just up to you whether you want to risk the wrath of the Drengen. And so I did. And then I also, after I took that, I realized there was two other worlds, one of which was right next to an Iconian starbase, which is kind of rude to take, because it's in their territory, but I took it. And then the other one is right next to their home world. It's kind of a shitty planet, but I took it anyway. And I just focused on, like, culture stuff. And I simplified culture too, I think. I can't totally remember how it worked, but now it's really simple. It's just influence. There's just a thing called influence, and everything that increases your influence increases the borders around your territory, like how much of the space near your planets is yours. And if there's another faction near there, then the strength of your borders pushing against their borders is given by your influence. And also, there's an influence kind of growth rate, and that's what most of these influence increasing things do. They don't give you a set amount of influence, they just increase your influence per turn. And I guess it's probably per population as well. And so you just kind of, you set those things up and they kind of like act like a multiplier on how big your borders grow each turn. And having those two worlds right next to both of the other races in the galaxy meant that I could kind of push my borders against them really early on. And I got obsessed with influence. I was just like, because now it's added a, kind of a very small thing, but just a critical weak spot in my nerd obsessions, which is adjacency bonuses.
Oh, no.
Supreme Commando, where you put two power generators next to each other, and they both help each other generate power, and then you get like a bonus for that, but they're explosive barrels, so now if one of them dies, it's going to blow it all. There are no explosive barrels in this, but you do get adjacency bonuses for putting similar buildings next to each other, and then there are also special buildings that, instead of giving you like a global bonus to research, they just give a massive bonus to research buildings that are touching them. So they don't do anything themselves, and it's a question of, is it worth having one of those in the center of all your research centers, or is that a problem because actually that's marshland over there and you can't build anything there, so you won't get the maximum adjacency bonuses. And if it is marshland, can you unlock a terraforming tech that will turn it into habitable land, and then can you get the adjacency bonus from that? And then after you've done that, wouldn't it be better to have a research center in the middle, because then it would get this, not only a bonus from those research centers, but it would give a research bonus to them as well. And so the maths of where you place these things is just like perfectly laser focused, the kind of thing that I will get obsessed with. And so that was why I went down the influence route, was just like, I colonized the planet and had a massive influence bonus if I place an influence thing on that tile. And then if I do that, then I should also place another influence thing next to it, because then I get an adjacency bonus in addition to that. And if I can wrangle it so that that tile is also next to my starting colony, that gives a bonus to almost anything. So I got it so that, like, this thing had 7 bonuses on it, and then that made my borders really big and could encompass people's territories. And it was kind of a total fool's errand, because culture is the slowest, most tedious way to take anything over. It's never really going to work, because you have to, in order to do it, you have to be right next to your enemy, and you have to be there for a long, long time, influencing them, which pisses them off. And the only way to survive that is to have a really big military, so, because they're going to attack you for that. They're going to be, like, if they're military, and if they're militaristic and you're strong in culture, of course they're going to attack you for trying to do a cultural takeover. So the only way you survive it is you have a better military than them. And if you have a better military than them, why are you bothering with a cultural takeover? You could just crush them. So, I was thinking, like, it's just going to be a waste of time. But then I colonized a planet, and you often get these moral dilemmas in Gal Civ where you colonize a planet and it'll say, oh, there's been a virus outbreak on this planet, and it kills 5% of the people it infects, but the 95% who survive become much smarter. So we can cure it. We found the cure, but do you want to cure it? Because if you leave it, then the research benefits might outweigh the loss of population. And you have 3 options. There's like the totally good option, the totally evil option, and the kind of pragmatic options. Like, maybe leave some people if they volunteer or something. And now you always get points for that, I think. Like, there was kind of some kind of allegiance thing where, you know, really evil races would get lots of malevolence points and they would not like the more benevolent races. And that's back, but now it unlocks ideologies, like in Civ, where you kind of... Do you remember, like, I think it's... Is it policies or... There's something in Civ where you build up culture points and then that lets you unlock...
There's like a separate tech tree for, it's where how religion is handled as well, like national philosophies.
So this isn't related to culture, it's just purely good and bad decisions, just like when you do moral things and amoral things or immoral things. There's even, like, there is one of the dimensions is pragmatism. You can get more pragmatism points by doing the middling thing. And I discovered that if you do the benevolent thing, once you get a certain number of points, you'll get to unlock a new tech and you kind of, or a new policy or whatever it is, ideology. And they have like 5 different branches just for benevolence, and then 5 different branches for pragmatism, 5 different branches for malevolence. Malevolence are things like driving your people to work themselves to death. And we can now live on these toxic worlds, not because we found a way to terraform toxic worlds, because we just don't care. We'll just let them all die. And in benevolence, one of them was, they're all quite... Some of them are good, but they kind of sound, some of them a bit wishy-washy. One of them was like, oh, you can build a new building that could do like 5% something, and I got that one. And then there's another one, was like, oh, I get you global, like 10% more influence, and that's good, I wanted more influence. And then number 3 when you unlock it, everyone, every planet and starbase in your territory flips to your side. Instantaneously. So all you have to do is get your territory borders over the enemy homeworld, which is difficult, but it's not anything like as difficult as culture flipping them. And so I just devoted everything to, like, building all these star bases around that planet I'd taken near the Drengen so I could get my borders pushed over their borders. I'm like, if I can just get... I was, like, one tile away from it, and I couldn't see how many benevolence points I have. And when you get enough benevolence points, you have to spend them. So I would either have to get the tech then and waste it, or, you know, not get their planet at least, or get a totally different tech and then have to work, like, basically be back to ground zero and have to work up another 40 points or whatever it is. And so I had no idea what my time limit was, and I was, like, so close to taking over the homeworld, or to having the homeworld in my influence. And I was rushing in, like, just mass-producing constructor vessels to build more and more starships near them. They kept threatening me with these fleets of ships, and I had no defenses at all. They could have taken all my star bases out and destroyed my world, but I was like, ah, just don't kill me just yet. If I can just get this one little border over your homeworld, they don't know that's significant at all. It doesn't make them rebel. It doesn't cause them any actual problem. Their rebellion rate was still 0%. And so it's not a thing they worry about, but if I can do it, then I can culture flip their only world. And I got that far, and then I discovered I was miles away from having enough benevolence points to do it. And so that was annoying, and you know, I only make like 3 benevolence points every 10 turns, and I needed 40 of them.
Hmm.
But as I was doing it, I realized I actually could, with that world, the shitty world I took next to my allies, I could probably, if I put enough star bases around that, create a little puddle of my territory and their territory that would just overlap their home world. So that I would take them as well. And after like 35 turns, I managed to do it, and then I figured out how to find out how much benevolence points you had. I figured out all the buildings you got to build to get the most benevolence points and be the most benevolent person ever. And then did it such that I destroy both my ally and my enemy at the same time.
What's the kind of fluff reason for it? What's the logic reason for the big...
I think the flavor text says that we've become so... I think it's preeminence or something it's called. And preeminence level 3 is we've become so desirable that everyone who knows about us wants to join our cause. They just, like, love us so much.
I loved it because in, like, I guess too, it's like broadcast stations and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I love the idea of, like, corrupting the populace by putting out a really good series of Doctor Who. They'd be like, holy shit, that was good. Who made this?
Just the Steam sale. It functionally destroys all other forms of...
It's like, yeah, I'd want to be one with those guys.
Those little bits of flavor text and the ways in which Gaussiv lets you manipulate populations is just the best thing about it, because it's just such a funny, characterful thing, like, that you don't get in Civilization.
No.
There's no sense of a city's population, or no real sense of being able to dominate or control them in these wacky ways. Like, I saw a screenshot of Gaussiv 3, which I think was, they discovered a historical text which was found to be deeply erotic to all alien species and caused them to go into a mating frenzy.
I've had that one.
And I think it was like a lame pun. I think it was called like 50 Shades of Snorlax or something like that.
That's probably exactly it.
It sounds like an alien name. I know it's Pokemon. But
Snorlax. Yeah. It does sound like a gas impression.
Yeah. That sounds great.
I had one, like, one of those moral choice events where I was told I could bug the United Planets. Someone told me there was going to be bugs planted there, and I could either report it to the United Planets or get access to them. And the malevolent option is, okay, get access to the bugs, and then pay this guy whatever he wants, and then pay him a little bit more to shut him up, and then kill him to be sure.
If you notice that, of course, Gauss is famous for its really fierce AI, like, it's fiercely clever AI, like, its understanding of its own, the game's own system has really been really, really good. Does that carry through to Gaussiv 3, do you think?
So it's only the tutorial, so I think a lot of the stuff is disabled.
Yeah.
Because I was putting culture star bases right next to my ally, and as soon as I did it, he messaged me to say, don't fucking do that. I know what you're doing, don't do that. And I said, the options are like, sorry, the star base will be destroyed immediately, or the star base stays. The star base stays. And then I sent like 6 more constructors to put another star base right next to him, and he just never did anything about it. He was also fucking crazy. He's like... balanced to be your tutorial buddy, so he keeps telling you how to do things, they'll give you free techs and say, oh, you want to invade the Drengen, here's your planetary invasion tech, which is, yeah, we do have a common enemy, but you never want to give an ally planetary invasion. If they can't invade your planets right now, you don't want to change that.
Yeah.
And then they would do stuff like, sometimes just say, oh, could you help us out? We need like 75 credits. And then a few turns later they say, hey, you're our friend. We want to give you 75 credits. Okay. And then they say, oh, can we have this tech from you, please? And I say, yeah, right, whatever. And then, like, a few turns later, they say, we want to give you a tech. But then randomly, that was all, I think that's mostly tutorial stuff. But then randomly, they would also just interject to say, the time will come when we'll eradicate you infidels from the universe. Like, I'm sorry, what?
It's a really strange relationship with the flatmate.
So it's almost like Farmville, where like it encourages you to share tech with other people in order to like suck them into playing the game, because in order to get this thing in our tech tree, we have to give you this thing.
The hilarious thing that they did do, I'm sure as a result of the AI, was I was putting those star bases around their home world, and my influence of that shitty planet started to become big enough to create a little pocket of my influence within their home system. And it was expanding and expanding, and it got to the point where it's just like one tile away from their system, and I kind of owned half their system by influence. And they opened up a trade window and said, could we buy your tech called Influential Voice? Because we find ourselves in need of some kind of influence tech.
That's great.
Galsa 2 is terrifying. I remember seeing a screenshot of like a Drangin statement, and I really hope it's not fake, but it was a statement from the diplomat on their side saying, you've set the difficulty too low, so we don't technically know what you're doing by putting all your ships near us. However, we do know what you are doing, and you know
one thing about it.
You know that we know what you're doing, but we are not able to act on this. But
I just realised,
yeah, that is real.
The story of your tutorial is functionally the plot of Mean Girls. As in, a new kid arrives at school but gets adopted.
Stop trying to make Iconia happen. It's not going to happen.
Exactly. Like, gets adopted by the nerdy kids, but then, like, then they, you know, she becomes, you know, you became plastic for a while. And they're like, not really sure what they made about it. Like, yeah, they're not sure if they want to learn from you or if, you know.
Did the leaders have the personality that they used to? Is the leader of the Terrans still called?
Oh, no,
Jeff?
Someone. Paul Davis.
Paul Davis. Just as not Paul. Good.
Who in one of my papers is called Paul Davis, Mutilator of World's Blood.
Do you get like the preeminence bonus is just you breaking up a tiara and throwing it around the galaxy?
So I don't know yet because it was a tutorial, but they seemed pretty similar. I mean, I think, like I say, I think that was the AI's personality breaking through. Like, Iconians don't necessarily love Terrans, and we had some ideological differences. Yeah. And so, every now and then, they were just like, can't resist telling you we want to kill you.
But the game designers have told us to teach you how to play this.
Like, yeah, but here's a new free tech. Here's $75.
We secretly fucking hate you.
If you hadn't been you, do you think the tutorial, how long would the tutorial have taken you?
That's a hard question. That's hard to answer.
Because you say 6 hours, like, do you think that you could do it in 4 hours or 30 minutes?
I think probably like an hour.
Okay.
You'd have to, it's hard to tell because I left it so long to do anything to them that by the time I did, they had hundreds of ships because they just had nothing else to do but make ships. And it was, my strategy was so bad. Like, if it had been a real game, I would have lost so fast. But, so once, if I had decided to take over their planet by invasion, I would have needed to take out those fleets. And I did take out those fleets in the end because I was doing a culture victory, and so you need a badass military to defend your culture victory. So I dominated their military and then still did the culture flip. But yeah, I think if I'd been faster, at the time they tell you, your allies tell you, oh, here's how to invade a planet, here's a troop transport thing. They're saying it as if you can just go and do it right now. And at that time, I hadn't scouted the Drangin planet, so I couldn't see if it had any defences. But if it did have defences, it's a question of whether the ships they gave you to start with are good enough to take them over, or whether you have to make your own fighter ships. But I think it's probably quicker.
Sounds promising. Sounds like they're, you know, like they're getting there.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's not the lead designer.
Oh, it's out.
No, is it?
Ah.
Yeah, sorry, it's out.
I think it just came out on Tuesday?
That's why I'm playing it, because it's been in early access for ages, and I didn't want to play an unfinished version. So.
Yeah.
I'm playing it. Although I've already discovered a pretty serious bug where there's now, one of the things you can do with Starbases is capture a resource, and the resources are like sort of luxury resources in Civ, where if you own some silk, you have like 1 point in silk, and then some things require you to have 1 point in silk. And they have those, but they're like Gerantium and Illyrium and that kind of stuff. And Illyrium's really good for beam weapons. And once you have a resource of Illyrium, one of the ships you can build is called like a prototype assassin ship, which uses a special Illyrium mega death laser, and that costs one Illyrium to build. And I didn't know whether that meant you have to have one Illyrium and then you can build them forever, or everyone you build consumes one Illyrium and therefore you don't have any Illyrium left and you can only build one. So I built one, and there's a little button you can click to say, not only do I want to build this, but I just want to keep building it on loop forever. And if you click that button, turns out you do need one Illyrium per thing, but it doesn't check when it tries to build the next one if you click the infinite loop button. So I built like 7 of them, and I had -6 Illyrium, which I don't think makes any sense. So I couldn't build any Illyrium things, but I had these 6 Illyrium assassin ships that I shouldn't have had.
I think the developer said that they're basically going to spend the next 5 years supporting it with like expansions and stuff like that, which is cool.
That's good.
The lead designer said, "Yeah, he's going to be working on it for another 5 years," and he said, "And that's my life, basically." By which I think he meant that he's going to be working on it full time.
I think he said, "And that's my entire life, or like that's my the rest of my life, or something like that." Like it made it sound like he was dying. He's going to be dead in the next 5 years. Which is not the case.
Maybe he's downloading his personality to one of the factions. Maybe that's what's breaking out in the tutorial.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Yeah. We have a letter from Anonymous, who says, "Hi guys, wanted to give you some info about the Magic Circle since I heard your podcast, episode 86, Jesus Christ, that was a while back. The Ishgilda character is clearly based on Warren Spector far more than anyone else. I didn't work on the Magic Circle, but I know a guy who did, and since both he and I worked with Warren on different games, the references are pretty obvious. Yes, there are probably parts that are related to Ken Levine or Richard Garriott, but at least 90% of the Ishgilda character is Warren Spector. When I worked at Ironstorm Austin, Warren wanted to rename the studio. He wanted the name Liminal Games, like Subliminal without the sub. But when he went to GDC, literally every single person he mentioned the idea to laughed in his face. So he changed his mind at the last moment, and after spending a huge amount of time trying to come up with a new name, like Angry Robot Games, we ended up just sticking with Ironstorm Austin. Another example of us being unable to make a decision, something a Magic Circle game points out really nicely. And you'll notice that the spaceship in the game is called the SS Liminal. Mentions that there's a bunch of obvious references to System Shock, which I think is in no doubt, right? we all know it's a System Shock reference. And then he makes a point about Showdown, but then he takes it back in a PS, so I'm not going to read that one out. And there's another one I think is a bit too personal to read out, because we can't verify any of this, and we don't know really whether this is true. So the Liminal thing is really interesting. If that's true, then that sounds like a direct reference. But he says, more info as I play through it, and again, if you use any of this info, please keep me as anonymous, which we have. I wanted to read this because I thought, well, firstly, that Liminal detail is interesting if it's true, because that probably is a direct reference. But Jordan Thomas has been pretty clear about the fact that none of this is based on one particular character. Like, all of the people in this are amalgams of various people, and also that everything they're guilty of has to be something that he personally is guilty of. So there'll be some Jordan Thomas in Ishgilda as well as... or I think the team. Like, it doesn't have to be him personally, but him, Kane, or Stephen, the three guys who are making it. They have to be parodying things that they have at some point committed. I'm sure there are loads of parallels between this character and Warren Spector, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's specifically based on Warren Spector. And in fact, having known quite a few people who worked with sort of legendary game designers, it's amazing how similar their reports of those legendary designers are, their complaints about them.
Yeah, it's maybe more interesting, not in terms of its insight into the Magic Circle for the reasons that you just described, but just for what this anonymous person thinks of Warren Spector, a person that they worked with.
Yeah.
But it's clear playing the Magic Circle, there are a lot of demons being exercised in the games that are overscoped and could never happen. Games that people have worked many, many years on that have been canned and gutted. So you're kind of playing through the corpses of a lot of, the System Shock thing is like the corpse of a game that has never met release. And of course, in the industry, you hear about many, many, many games that never ever come out.
Yeah.
Many designers have committed many years of their lives to. So it's actually quite profound in that way.
I saw the trailer for it the other day, again, for the first time since it first came out. I think as I went to just the Steam store page for it, and that's what plays when you go there, and I was reminded by how good job that does of explaining a very difficult game to explain. That's just like, if you task me with making a trailer for that game, I just don't know where the hell to start, because it's a game, but it's about a game, and it's the game that it's about is the game that you're playing, but at the same time it's not the game that you're playing, because it hasn't been delayed by 20 years, and it's the people who made it are not the same people who made this game, and they're both called the same thing, they both have the same name, which confuses the issue. And, yeah, just by doing a sort of, like, prototype trailer that then has a bunch of corrections scrawled over it and is, like, a sort of first draft. It doesn't make any sense what they're showing you, because no one would correct a trailer by actually adding images to the trailer to annotate it. But it tells you what's happening. It kind of gives you the sense of, like, there, here's a trailer for a game, and the thing you're going to play is this, but there's also this development process going on top of it as another layer.
Mm-hmm.
Kane writes, did you know that there's a little Titanfall competitive tournament going on right now? It's quite intense. I had a thought about Titanfall's competitive scene in the context of Chris's talk about scrubs in an episode last year. To paraphrase slightly, Chris defined a scrub as somebody who either complains about or intentionally chooses not to employ exploits or tactics that they consider overpowered or otherwise unfair in a competitive game. The Titanfall competitive scene has a ton of really strict rules that they impose on teams to limit things they consider unsporting or boring. For example, you're limited to 2 shotguns per team, at most 1 player per team can use arc mines, smart pistols are banned altogether, and the explosive pack is also banned. By Chris's definition, and Serlin's definition in the blog post that was being discussed in that episode, it seems that, like that would make the entire Titanfall competitive community scrubs. Is it different when the community broadly agrees on the restrictions that they've put in place? What do you think about highly restrictive community-designed rules for competitive play? Unrelated to my question, they also have a really interestingly counterintuitive rule, which can be set in a private game lobby, making it part of the game and therefore non-scrubful. that each player only gets 1 Titan per match. For a game called Titanfall, you'd think that was that limiting people to only 1 Titan would erode the uniqueness of it, but it actually adds some really interesting strategy. CTF has 2 rounds, so if you drop your Titan in the first half, even if it survives the entire first half, you won't have a Titan in the second half. It makes when a team drops their Titans an extremely significant strategic choice. Commiserations on your election.
On the point of whether or not I totally agree with David Serlin, I've actually written some sense about the ways in which I don't totally agree with him and his definition of what scrubs mean. I think it's very specific in some ways to the fighting game community, more so than I subsequently realised when I first read it, because it's obviously a very influential philosophical take on, you know, what it is to play a game competitively, what's cheating, what's right.
Shall we give a kind of top-down overview of what it is?
Yeah, I think it's almost been given in the last film. Basically, the notion of Serlin's definition of a scrub is somebody who almost plays for the aesthetic value of a particular method, chooses a way of competing for partly its aesthetic value rather than its efficaciousness in the game. It's probably
there is a correct way to win.
Yeah.
You know, in some sense.
It's
a beautiful game, like beautiful football, right? So, Arsenal deserves to win if they play beautiful football. But they,
Yeah, it's like Chelsea, you know, play to win. And people criticise them because they just defend and they park the bus and, you know, and everyone else is a scrub.
Defending, one goal. Gotcha.
The main thing about that makes you a scrub, because the idea is that if the strategy exists, if mashing out dragon punch after dragon punch wins...
Yeah, that is valid.
That is valid.
Yeah.
And one of my objections to that is actually that only applies in the context of organised competition. It doesn't actually apply in the vast majority of cases where people throw it around, which is what could be determined as learning to play or practicing.
Hmm.
In practicing, particularly in PC games where balance patches are a real thing, again, that comparison comes from console games, particularly fighting games, where you get, you know, one version of Street Fighter and it's Street Fighter 3, First Strike, or whatever, and that is that set of commands, and they will be the same forever. In a game which has balance patches, and particularly where players spend so more time practicing than competing, experimenting with sub-optimal strategies is actually really incredibly important. And playing and refusing to use overpowered strategies is also actually really incredibly important, because that's how you learn.
Hmm.
Because you have to be aware of the broad scope of the game, not just the specifically powerful stuff, because the game will change. That's my objection to his thing broadly. I don't know if the podcast being referred to is back when I agreed with him, but... Hmm. With regards to Titanfall, I think the process they're describing there is really the community stepping in to do something that were Titanfall... Had Titanfall sadly not really lost its momentum as a game, generally, the developers would be doing, which is determining competitive mode. It exists in every game, right? Like, there are modes in League of Legends that don't get played in tournaments, there are modes in Smite, in Dota, in Counter-Strike. in every single, in StarCraft. You know, you don't see 2v2 or 2v3 as the format for competitive StarCraft. Every single esport has the way it's played competitively. Often that involves stripping out, like, just for fun or accessibility features.
Mm.
And so, therefore, I don't really see them as being scrubs, because they've just, it's just that the community has themselves done the job of the developer and established a set of new rules to help.
It's a tremendous history of PC gaming communities doing this stuff, and often through mods, where, you know, previously, like, the way that competitive modes in Counter-Strike were formed was simply through the way modding of game modes, the creation of new game modes. And I love the idea of communities house ruling a game to make it more, you know, viable as competitive sport for themselves.
I might plug something, actually, because I'm doing in London next week on Tuesday. I'm doing so this will come out on Friday, Tuesday the 26th of May. I'm doing a talk at Video Brains in London about sport and games, basically, to come at the topic of, you know, is it sport from a different angle? Because I don't think that needs to be either a validation argument or a semantic argument. And to spoil a bit of it, like, become, and it applies to this, is sport is actually rules. Sport isn't athletics. Sport isn't the action. The sport is the rule that governs the action. Because otherwise what you have is just a series of actions. Kicking is not, football isn't kicking. Football is rules that govern kicking. And therefore, the creation of rule sets to determine what you do is the sport. Like, what they have done is created sport Titanfall by applying rules to Titanfall. A bit like you create football by applying rules to a field, a ball, and some people. Like, that is what sport is. So yeah, I would definitely not say that it's scripts on that base.
It's interesting that this comes up in just, like, every sport. Like, one of the biggest stories of the last year was when football manager Sam Allardyce described Manchester United as long ball United. Because, like, that was like... pretty much. Yeah. Like, it was the fact that, like, Manchester United have been dominant in English football for a couple of decades now, for playing very fast, passing football with flying wingers and really dynamic and interesting. And so, whereas, like, just hoofing the ball up to your big tall man who's standing up by the goals. Huffing it to the tall man. That's lower division football. Mm. Like, that's Route 1, it gets called. Like, that's the most basic fucking football. And so to, like, accuse Manchester United of this because they happen to have a Belgian player who's 6'8". it's like, scandal. and you know, it's a constant feature of football. Like, Chelsea have just won the English Premier League, and they've been criticised a bunch, despite playing a whole bunch of really interesting football, for just defending really, really well. Whereas, like, Arsenal haven't won the league in over 10 years, but regularly play the most attractive looking football, and that's part of the philosophy.
Mm. Like, classic on the international stage. I mean, Italy were the classic.
Defend.
But it's true. Like, but I think because these sports make their money out of spectators, like so much of their money, or sponsorship is huge, but like spectators as well. There's a sense among spectators that they're owed by the sport. I think that counts in. I mean, it must count in for esports as well, in some sense.
But that's much more common in America, I think.
Right.
Of although there is criticism over here for football, which is successful but not entertaining, it's much, much greater in America and in Canada.
Hmm.
Like, if you play basketball or baseball in ways which are deemed to be unentertaining, then, you know, people are furious about it, and managers will get sacked for it. And
really?
Stuff like that. Yeah,
wow.
Like, because it is.
There was a case in StarCraft 2 in the GSL, the Korean tournament, where a player was kicked out of the league, and I think kicked out of his team, basically lost his job, because he was in a matchup where the tournament structure meant that it didn't matter who won. Mm. Like, there was no point in him winning it, it wouldn't gain him anything. And so he had just selected all his drones and just right-clicked on the enemy base, just basically attacked all his workers, which is a strategy that is sure to fail. And it did fail, but it was considered, like, unsportsmanlike, because he didn't try to win the match, which was, like, I'm on his side. I think, like, if the tournament structure's fucked up, that's the tournament structure's fault.
That's
not your fault.
Happened in real sport, like, there was some very poorly devised tournaments in real sports where teams have been fined for not participating in the match properly, just like having a kickabout, passing to each other and never doing anything.
Yeah, because most sports have, if you've got a cup knockout tournament, then you have seeding, for example. So who you're going to play in the next round is determined partly by whether you're first, second, or third. But if you remove that, then players will sometimes, teams can play for second place rather than playing for first place.
Yeah. Kind of thing. And it's also the reason why a lot of, the final stages of major tournaments are, matches that play simultaneously, because obviously, if you know that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whether you win or lose, then, you know,
yeah,
the match is over. Anyway, yeah, it's interesting to see, like, these parallels between real sport and, well, obviously, because, like, esports is a real sport, because it behaves in the same way. It is.
It's one of the things we're going to talk about, like,
yeah.
There are far too many parallels that to get hung up on whether or not it's real exercise.
Yeah, seems exactly, like such a, yeah. Like, it's a secondary thing.
Like, there are a shitload of things in real life that are tiring, make you a bit puffed, and a lot of them aren't sports. You know what I mean? Like, as soon as you apply rules to them, they become sports. So therefore, what's the sport? Is it the getting tired, or is it the rules?
They're all very awkward. Like, Parliament defines mind sports differently to...
Mind sports.
So we're talking about chess and things like that.
Golf is a really interesting case, because there's lots of people who say, like, golf isn't a sport, it's a pastime. But it's like, well,
massive amounts of skin involved.
Semantic territory.
It's another one.
One of the least physically active sports.
Mind sport.
Slow sport where you can be fat.
There's a huge amount of physical skin involved in this thing. Like precision posture and stuff.
A lot of the stuff to do with, like, competitive versus entertainment is relevant outside of sport in games as well. And there was a really interesting article on a board games website a few weeks ago about this, about people who approach a board game, and one of person is, like, say Warhammer, one person is there to learn and to have fun, and one person is there to just win.
Oh yeah.
And how
spoils it for everyone.
intent basically going in when it's not clear could just cause arguments, can cause friendships to be destroyed, could just cause both people to not have a good time. And, like, this was a person who's a teacher and runs, like, an after school game club where, like, someone will rock up with, like, who's never played Warhammer and has just bought their first army, and it's really kind of basic and they're really excited to play, and the experienced player who's got, like, this fucking huge army which is brilliant and is just gleeful with the opportunity to destroy this person who's never played the game before.
Oh man,
like, they're both playing in the way that they want to play, but it results in this one person perhaps never playing the game ever again because they just have a terrible experience. And the article is about, and we'll link it in the show notes, is just about the importance of people communicating, basically, of, like, talking beforehand about what they want, like, as if it's a relationship.
What do you want from this game?
Yeah.
What's the long-term future of our position in this game?
Like, what's our safe word?
Well, yeah, are we here to win? Well, just have fun.
The metaphor which this article uses, and I don't know if this is true, is apparently the gay dancing scene in 1970s San Francisco, which apparently came up with a code.
Yeah, I know.
Apparently came up with a code based on handkerchiefs in your back pocket and, like, which pocket it was in, and I think what colour it was, and that, like, communicated to other people whether you were single and looking, or whether you were just there to dance, or whether you were
I wish that was... That's just make it fucking clear. I don't mind.
Please put the gays in charge of this.
Disco semaphore is not something they're really made into Warhammer, and it's
solved so much disappointment in clubs if people could just, like, adequately project what the situation was.
How do we get there?
No, it was good. Via StarCraft.
Deacon writes, "Dear Carton and Churchkey, I've been listening to past episodes, and after about 40 of them, I feel like I know you much better than I actually do. I heard a small aside a couple of episodes back concerning the use of German loanwords in Japanese. There was some conjecture about the source being World War II, and since they were both fascist states and Axis powers, this is an understandable misunderstanding. I'm not an expert, but I did live in Japan for about 13 years, and I rate myself rather cunning linguist. Here is my take on it. In the late 1860s through the early 1910s, Japan went through the Meiji Reformation and went from feudalism to an industrialized nation in a very short time. During that time, Japanese envoys cherry-picked Europe and the rest of the world for the best, most modern bits they could find. Bits and bobs from everywhere, really. But they based their government on that of France, military, education and medical system on Prussia. So lots of medical terms come from German. Most Japanese people are not aware of this and assume most loan words are of English origin, and they will mistakenly assume English speakers should know these terms. Confusion, frustration, and hilarity ensues. Thanks for the great podcast, Deacon McMillan.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Just an interesting factoid.
Interesting etymology.
What were the loan words? Were there specific?
I'd love to know, actually.
God, what, do we, what, isn't that how we got onto Werner the Herzog? Because I was talking about Herzog 2, which is...
I feel like I wasn't here for this podcast.
Shooter.
Right. Clément. I'm going to pronounce it that way, because he's got a cute accent.
I put that acute accent in it, because he has a French name, and I don't know who I've read this out to say Clement.
Okay. Dear Boxes and Magpie Taverns, after that terrible attempt at a pun, let me congratulate you on this podcast of yours. Really enjoying listening to the ideas and nonsense you give to the world every week. Lovely. And that's it. just a quick question, which is podcast-related, if not video game-related. In a recent episode, one of you, I think it was Graham, actually we think it was Chris.
It was actually me.
mentioned the problem with the second half of Skyfall. And I wondered, what is it? I genuinely cherish this Bond movie, though I am aware it's problematic in some respects, and I would like to know what you guys think about it.
Oh my god.
Cheers and congrats again.
So he genuinely cherishes it. Do we want to destroy it?
I'll start by explaining what I meant when I referred offhand to the problem with the second half of Skyfall. Hmm. I can't remember what the game context for this was.
It doesn't matter anymore, Chris.
But
Skyrim, probably.
My problem with the second half of Skyfall is that to be honest, I'm not a huge James Bond fan generally, and I enjoyed the deconstruction of that character that happened at the beginning of the Craig Bonds, and more broadly lament it's just turning back into Bond. But in Skyfall's particular case, there's a moment basically midway through that movie where the need to make a James Bond 50th anniversary special that sets up the next generation of movies by basically, like, you know, leaning on nostalgia effectively, like, swallows the movie that is being set up in the first half of the film. The movie set up in the first half of the film is, it's not exactly hugely original, but it's about, you know, the extent that people will go to kind of protect state secrets. It's about an old spy movie concept, which is about the big list of agents' names being leaked and that kind of thing. And there's, you know, there's a villain with a set of motivations, you know, to do with presumably data security. It feels like they wrote a film that where the villain was functionally a merger of, like, Blofeld and Julian Assange. Like, and that was the film that they chose to write. And then about the midway point of Skyfall, pretty much exactly after he uses the radio and the helicopters show up to rescue him from that island off the coast of Japan, I think it is, it turns into, like, the James Bond Universal Studios tour, right? Where, you know, it kind of establishes that the Craig Bond is actually in continuity somehow with the jetpack Bond and the ejector seat Aston Martin Bond and all this stuff. And it goes to the big warehouse full of old Bond toys, there's loads of quips, it does loads with the backstory. And it ends with the restoration of the old Bond status quo, basically fundamentally undoing every interesting creative change someone made to that series since Brosnan. Like, it gets rid of, it gets rid of female M, it restores Q to the role of, like, you know, kind of like wiry British, very, you know, different actor, but, you know.
Yeah.
It takes the character, you know, it takes the most prominent female agent in those films, and the reveal is that she's Moneypenny and will be sat behind a desk forever now. Like, it's this act of...
You thought I was a co-spy, but actually I'm a...
Yeah, and I actually, even in cases where I really do love the source material, like Star Wars, like you were talking about earlier, I don't trust that remember the good old days urge in creative anything. Like, I don't, obviously, in some cases people try and change things and they really fuck it up. And I get that not everyone liked Casino Royale, I really did. But that for me was just so gutting, because, like, it's fan service, but it's not saying anything. Like, it has nothing to say other than remember this.
There's also, like, a massive, like, tonal conflict in the last section where you have that nostalgia, which is actually, like, really, the car stuff is kind of fun. And then it goes into dark, look, this is where Bond came from stuff, which is really never been what James Bond's been. It's never been about, like, digging up the past and having this old, dark Scottish manor and then this, like, harrowing chase across the moors in the dark where, you know, you're being shot at and you're injured. And this kind of, that, you're doing the bright, kind of happy, hey, look at all the cool things you remember about Bond and its history and celebrating the history into this kind of, combined at the same time with this dark, horrible, kind of harrowing thing. And then a kind of, like, reversal at the end, that rewind, as you say.
That darkness would be fine with the movie that starts off as. Yeah. That's what I think, like, it's not like, I mean, I talk about there being a clean break, there almost is, but it's almost like the movie that it used to be fights back, like, yeah. Like M's speech, about, you know, essentially, she basically gives the Night's Watch oath at the end of that film, where, like, we are the, you know, we're the shield that guards the realms of men. Like, and, you know, she gives this speech, which is about, like, and she's not necessarily right, and it's quite scary, but it's about, like, why she believes she should be above the law in order to do whatever.
Yeah.
And it's quite a powerful moment for that character, which is completely undercut, because the action sequence that surrounds it is completely ridiculous.
Like, that's more my problem with it. Like, right. I don't, like, I hate the Moneypenny thing. Mm. I don't mind so much, the introduction of Q, partly because I really like Ben Whishaw as an actor.
So great.
I'm glad that he's part of it, and I don't mind that Ralph Fiennes joins the cast, because I really like him as an actor as well, and, you know, that's fine. But the second half of that film makes no fucking sense whatsoever. Like, Bad Guy's plan was to apparently be deliberately caught, which is a lame-ass thing, knowing a particular thing that he would be able to escape, and then there's this... And
he's
then
hacked
his,
us!
He's like... All these years of planning, and his plan is to basically dress up as a policeman and walk into the fucking courtroom where Judy Dench is, like, giving testimony. And then Bond's plan for protecting them is to go to a fucking abandoned Scottish house that he's never been to in, like, 40 years. And the fucking groundskeeper is still there.
And do you know who was originally done by Sean Connery? It was originally going to be Sean Connery as well. Yeah, that was the that was what
it looked like. They wanted to get Brian Cox and couldn't get him. Yeah, but like,
but the other thing is, like, there's a moment that we're talking about a film now, but that's fine. The moment that film really fucks it is when okay, a villain wants to be caught as part of his plan. He's getting inside MI5, whatever. He escapes, he goes down the thing, and yes, he's planned his route out through where he knows MI5 will go or something like
that.
The secret tunnels, Churchill's tunnels. So he's going, and he's going up through the subway tunnels, and Bond catches him just as he's climbing a ladder back up to the street level. And Bond's standing there in the lower tunnels, and he's up there on a ladder, and he says something like, you know, I've got a present for you, Mr. Bond, or something, at which point he presses a button, the wall explodes, and an empty underground train comes through the wall and crashes down on top of Bond. And it's obviously supposed to be a death trap. And obviously there are convoluted death traps in James Bond all the time. But how do you plan to be on a ladder as knowing the tunnels and know that the man who poses the biggest threat to you will chase you? And you know that he'll chase you to the point where you know where to blow up to get a train that is empty to go through the wall to land on that man. If you're standing anywhere else, then it's not going to work. Like...
And it still doesn't work, goddammit.
I mean,
only our plan is slightly better.
Honestly, like, I don't necessarily think you can complain with, you know, you can't complain about, like, oh, why does he explain his evil plan and not just shoot him? Because it's, you know, there's certain tropes that you can kind of maintain. But that moment it makes so little sense that, like, it makes, I'm going to lower you into a vat of sharks look like that at least. Makes physical sense that you can see. It's
the sharks would kill you.
It's a stupid idea, but it's not so impossible to set up that it breaks the film. Whereas, like, everything about the logistics of that trap, like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, it's so
far. To vaguely relate this to video games, yeah. I find that video games give me a much more discerning taste in action movie. Like, I really need the mechanics of the movie to make sense now, because having played... I mean, I played video game versions of every movie scene you can think of, you know, every action scene you could ever want to do. I played the real version of that. And by real, I mean fake. Because, I mean, video games. But video games have to have consistent rules. Most of the time they do, like, Call of Duty, maybe not. But, like, the Counter-Strike version of every gunfight you've ever seen actually does obey consistent rules. And so if you play Counter-Strike more than 3 times, you know what those rules are, and you know what you can and can't get away with, and you know that running out in front of a bunch of people shooting at you just doesn't fucking work. You're just a fucking idiot if you're doing that. And so every time Bond does that, I just tune out. I'm just like, but you're just a fucking moron. I don't care that none of the bullets hit you. You're a fucking moron. You would have been killed by any reasonable definition
kind
of the word.
Kind of why Edge of Tomorrow works. Oh, it's because he dies constantly. Of course you fucking die constantly. You're an action hero.
I mean, I think it comes back almost like to bad GMing as well. Like, that moment when the train comes crashing through the wall is a lot like, I don't know, like, GM didn't really anticipate that the player would get catch up with the boss, so it's like, oh, a train crashed through the wall. Where's it? Where did the train come from? No, we planned it. It was a trap.
It feels like there are a couple of instances in that film where the script bends around the action scene, so they've clearly come up with the action scene first, and then they have to go, oh, we've got to have to make this work and fit this in somewhere, because we've like probably filmed half of it now, and we scripted it.
Action scenes in action films are best when the conflict that's happening as two people punch each other is resolving some sort of either narrative conflict or emotional conflict between the characters. And when it doesn't have that, it feels empty. And when it also then breaks the rules of reality, it feels doubly so. Like, which is why, for example, the fight scenes in the first Matrix films work when there is a genuine rivalry and a certain element of physics being observed, and they're about self-actualization, versus the second film, where just like Neo fights at like 10,000 Agent Smiths, for no particular reason whatsoever, and then at the end of it, Neo just flies away, and the Agent Smiths are still there.
Which you could have done all the time,
it's just like, that doesn't mean anything. Or the Die Hard films, where like from the first film, where like the grandest stunt in the first Die Hard film is the helicopter explosion on the top of the building, and he swings over the side with the fire hose, which is like stretching credulity, but would actually physically function. And the rest of it is just like moving about the innards of the infrastructure of a skyscraper.
Yeah.
And one of the coolest moments is when he gets his feet all cut open with glass.
Yeah.
Versus the fourth film, where he gets hit by a car going at like 70 miles an hour and just immediately gets up and walks away. And then like 4 minutes later, launches a car into the air in order to destroy a helicopter. Both of which, like the first one would have killed him and the second one is physically impossible. And so you just think, well, this doesn't mean anything. Yeah. This is just fictional.
You just like, clock out. You clock out at that point. It's just like, well, though it's actually like
Die Hard 1 is not an unpopular film.
It's well regarded.
And yet, you're right. That is like a game that rigorously regards like physics and mechanics, and just says, okay, here are the rules. Here's the limited, very restricted situation. Here's the action we can milk out of that.
Yeah. It's Invisible Ink. It's Invisible Ink. It's set inside offices.
this is one of the reasons that the Casino Royale thing. They did it before in Bond. They forgot it. It's like the great bit in Casino Royale when it kind of all goes to shit at the end, and he races off in his kind of Bond sports car, and everyone knows what that symbol means. Like, it means car chase, right? Like that, and Bond is like both pissed up and on shitloads of painkillers at that point, I think, because he's been shot, and he's sort of haring down these roads, and then you have this like almost like two frame image of Eva Green's character tied up in the road in front of him in the headlights, and he flips the car over, and the chase lasts like 15 seconds, and then the car just tumbling down a hill. And it's that, like, it's clever, because it's like, guess what, you know, what do James Bond villains do? They tie up the love interest and put her in a death trap that James Bond has to get her out of. But they do that entire scenario in, like, this really grounded, terrifying way, in a really economical way, and have it completely subvert what you're expecting from that scene, in a way that's completely grounded in physics as well. Like, in a way, it's a testament to his skill as a driver, that he sees her in a second, has managed to flip the car over to save her life. But it's still a complete subversion. Like, the other film that's great for that is the new Mad Max, which does exactly that constantly. Like, it's constantly subverting what, you know, kind of surprising you with the both physical verisimilitude of this crazy shit that's happening.
I love the first sequence in... Well, I love all of it. But the first sequence in Mad Max where he is... they're trying to capture him, and they do capture him, and then he breaks out of being captured, and then he does, like, an amazing, proper protagonist, hero man job of getting away from him. He does everything right, just does everything perfectly, has this dramatic chase down a corridor, sees the corridor opening out into massive open space, and there's a hook right there for him to jump onto, and his hands are bound by chains, so he can hook the chains onto the hook which is also kind of neatly symbolic, because like the thing that they used to restrain him is now the thing that's actually letting him survive this thing. And he swings out there, and there's just fucking nowhere to go. And he swings back, and as soon as he swings back, they can hook him in, and they have like things that they hook him in with, so and then he's just fucked. And it's just like, he just did everything right, and he still got fucked for it. And that's so compelling. But it works immediately, like the guy, I'm on his side.
To make this about video games, that would be an acceptable fail state in a game.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
You get why you failed. Yeah. Like it's completely within the logic of the thing. And like,
I also think that Mad Max has basically invented a whole new load of action scenes that video games are now going to spend the next 10 years trying to emulate. So like the guys
with the Mad Max
guy is guys waving on poles like while suspended on cars, like that's going to be replicated. The whole like shooting people off motorbikes that are flying over you, like fucking loads of things in that film are going to be in games in the next 10
also,
years.
Also, I mean, and that's like, a good thing because it turns out they were all actually done. did everything in that film. Yeah.
Apparently, they put that film together from like 480 hours of footage. They were in Namibia for 6 months, blowing up trucks. Like,
all those, the pole thing was really done. The motorbikes that jump over the truck and throw the grenades down were really done. They actually did that.
The guy with the fucking electric guitar that fires fire, that was real. He just
really
did that.
It really did fire.
The amps actually worked, and it was actually.
it was all for real. Like, this game is
mind blowing.
I sort of call it a game then. It's but it's like, it's the best video game I've ever seen. Mad Max is so good.
Game of the year for sure.
George Miller just has the best career arc. Like Mad Max films, and then since the last Mad Max film, while he was making Babe Pig in the City and Happy Feet, has just been like writing down ideas.
We've managed to do like 20 minutes of a film podcast but like
I can go on.
There's an amazing interview I think with I've forgotten the name of the film website with George Miller, who is just the loveliest man. It's such a hyper-violent film and really aggressive.
Babe is a really good film. First Babe is great.
Yeah. Babe's legit. Yeah. Babe is legit as fuck.
Is it a slash film, maybe?
I think it's
the one I've seen.
I linked to it on Twitter.
And every question the guy asked, the guy is a real movie nerd and really delves deep into it. And he's like, if this is the... It makes like an analogy to a bunch of Western films. And everything he says is really deeply insightful and that he's really thought about it. And you can see, like, George Miller's eyes kind of light up at the questions. What a wonderful point. That's so good.
It's also the things he's saying are very flattering, like the comparisons to Buster Keaton and stuff like that. Like, and he just looks delighted to being praised for it. What a guy. Anyway, what were we talking about? Skyfall. We don't like Skyfall, we do like Memo.
Last thing I wanted to say was there's a meta arc to James Bond films, which is that they continually reboot in more realistic form. Like GoldenEye that, and there are elements of Skyfall which feel GoldenEye-ish, maybe just in the fact that the villain is a former agent who's been betrayed, which is like Sean Bean's character in the original GoldenEye. And this felt like this weird halfway house of we want to go back to the silly Tomorrow Never Dies sort of bullshit. What did I say?
I don't know why Siri is now on. I actually switched off the Wi-Fi so that Siri wouldn't butt in on this podcast.
Never mind. I've
special guest Siri.
She's done this before.
Yeah.
Lost my train.
Arc of the Bond films.
You're right. It's
Arc of the Bond films, bringing the silly back.
Cyclical.
Bringing silly back.
But that doesn't work for the cyclical thing.
Silly must be what you
thought. Oh yeah, that's what it was. It was the Bond identity is the reason why Casino Royale had to happen. Like your car chase example, like the Bourne films do that brilliantly. Like the first Bourne identity has a car chase and which is in a really shitty rundown mini through a bunch of crappy European streets in which they get hit by a lot of other cars. And the second film does the same thing, but in Russia. Like it's a car chases where it's not about, hey, look how cool this is in my fancy Aston Martin. It's, look, this is shit, and now my legs hurt.
It's also it's calling back to Bullet and a load of other like historically great car chases and films, which have been just about just doing it and then filming, just strapping a camera nearby and watching things bash into each other.
I can't remember the name of it right now, but we'll link it in the show notes. But there's like an 11-minute French short film, which is just about
they strapped a car to the front of a fucking Ferrari and he speeds against the law.
A car.
Yeah, there's a car on top of the car. It's Gary's mod.
There's a camera on the car.
No. They strap a car to No, they don't. They strap a camera to the car, and then they race through Paris, and they break the law.
Yeah, legitimately just speed through the centre of Paris for 11 minutes in a Ferrari with pedestrians crossing the road. Like, they did it, filmed it at, like, 5 in the morning or something like that. It's totally illegal,
yeah.
And there are points where they very almost kill people. And it's just this short film of, like, 11 minutes of speeding through the streets of Paris, and at the end, the car, like, skids to a halt, and you hear a car door close, and a guy walks in front, and he embraces a woman. And just, like, hugs his girlfriend or whatever it is. That's the end of the film, but it's just, like, incredible kind of speeding scene. Oh, Blues Brothers is also weirdly the other example of this, where they just legitimately sped cars through the streets of Chicago, and got the National Guard in and stuff like that, and crashed literally dozens of police cars, and when they asked for permission from Chicago to do this stuff, the local government said, no, you lunatics.
Right.
And so they got mobsters to help them with influence.
No way.
Because it was Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, and they were like from Chicago and hugely beloved in America at that point, and they had, you know, many friends.
Also, French Connection. Like an amazing cartoon. Yeah. French Connection. Anyway, so that was the 45-minute film podcast that intruded on our...
We like films.
But thank you for the question.
And that's why I'm sorry we don't like the film you like.
But for many very precise reasons.
I hope we made you dislike it too. Otherwise, it was a giant waste of time.
And if you ever choose to strap a car to a car, I will still watch that film. When
Actually, that does happen in Mad Max.
Sweet. So right.
Yeah,
it's the best film ever.
Yeah. There's a car with just another car on it.
Yeah. Man.
We have one last question, is about video games. Hello, gents. This is mostly a Chris question, but wait, don't stop reading. It's not about Dota. I understand the idea of playing a game on hard to further sell the experience that your back is against the wall, but what about a game where it makes more narrative sense to be completely in control? A good example of this is Star Wars The Force Unleashed. I hated how, even on normal difficulty, it would take 4 or 5 lightsaber swings to down just one stormtrooper, and I felt too vulnerable to even... Too vulnerable, considering I was a master of time, space, and the wonky havoc physics. Easy difficulty sold me on actually being a Jedi. Normal difficulty sold me on it mostly being a shit video game. Has anyone ever dropped the difficulty for a similar result? Cheers, Tom. And a bonus question, do you guys and gals listen to any podcasts about games? My workday has a lot of podcastable time, and your back catalogue is almost dry. So to the first question... Invisible Ink is a really interesting example of like the difficulty... totally changing the experience. I think, for me, experience is about right for it, and it does change the fantasy, it changes who you are and how you play it.
I think you don't want to drop it down also once you've actually reached
Yeah, you want to keep it as high as you can, but it is, the new easy mode is definitely worthwhile for new players. Deus Ex, all three Deus Exes have different points to make about this, I think. Deus Ex the first is... I only really play it on realistic difficulty, which is the maximum one, and to be honest, it makes almost no difference. Easy is not much easier at all. It's just a game where if you get shot in the head, you fucking die. That's just how the game works. And the difficulty level, I don't know what it changes exactly, but it's not that. Deus Ex 2, the reason I wanted to read this question is because this question made me specifically think of that. Because he says that his problem with Force Unleashed is that it takes 4 or 5 lightsaber swings to down one stormtrooper, which is fucking absurd. That's completely... just don't fucking make a Star Wars game if you want to make that game. Like, why the hell... what the hell are you doing? Even touching Jedi fiction if you think it takes 4 or 5 swings of a lightsaber to kill a stormtrooper. That's absurd. And I had the same kind of feeling with Deus Ex 2 when I first tried to shoot someone in the face and it didn't kill them. I was annoyed about that, and loads of people were annoyed about that, and it's one of the reasons Deus Ex 2 is so widely hated. Is that it just kind of betrayed realism to the point where it sort of seemed like it wanted to make things into, like, bullet spun nutrition battles, which made no sense. You can... all of the difficulty settings in Deus Ex 2 are in INI files. So you can actually edit the INI files and just change the multipliers for everything. You can change the multipliers for damage you do to enemies and damage enemies do to you. And so the first thing I did, even with the Deus Ex 2 demo, even before the full game was even finished, I modified the difficulty so that... I think I multiplied all damage you deal by 4 times so that a headshot would always kill someone. And to make it fair, I multiplied the damage people do to you by 4 times as well. so that they could kill you in one hit, and so you had to be really careful about avoiding damage, and it made the game like 10 times better. And the only disadvantage of it is, the only slightly flaw, is that it also multiplies fall damage. And the game is one of those ones where, like, fall damage kicks in pretty early, but is mild, and it's only if you fall a really long distance that it kills you. So if you fall, like, one story, it'll take off 5% of your health or something. But if you're multiplying all damage by 4, whatever the amount of health it does take off normally ends up being fatal. So, like, you have to be really careful on stairs. You have to be very, very worried about every tiny little drop. But other than that, it just makes Deus Ex 2 massively better. Hmm. And then, of course, Deus Ex 3 is the one where it has one of the difficulty levels is just called Deus Ex. Give me Deus Ex. And that is the best one to play on. And if you don't play on that, you kind of end up with a diluted game. It's kind of like, you don't have to do the things that Deus Ex is about, and so you can just shoot people, and if you do just shoot people, you kind of miss the point of the whole thing.
That's interesting, because I was going to mention The Witcher 3, actually, in this context, because I find that combat incredibly frustrating, The Witcher 3, just in terms of just, like, something about it really pisses me off. So I bumped it down to the lowest difficulty level, where it's just it becomes the mad power fantasy, where you just chop dudes up, and it's really satisfying and really fun. But that robs you of half the game, which is all about crafting potions and about crafting armor, which is a huge part of the whole RPG experience. So it's a bit of a weird trade-off there.
I've just started on Witcher 3. I played maybe, because it came out today when we're recording this, and I played maybe 4 hours of it today, and I fucking hate the combat already.
And it's like, horrible, isn't it?
And it's like, it makes sense that, say, like, the first kind of boss battle, so to speak, that you do is against the Griffin.
Yeah.
It kind of makes sense that that is hard.
It's a terrible fight.
But just, like,
so bad.
There are points where you're just fighting against bandits, and, you know, like, it's not a lightsaber that I'm wielding, but it is a sharp bit of steel, and I just have to smack them around the chops like I've got a wet fish in my hand in order to whittle down their health bar. And there are points at which those bandit fights break out inside taverns because you chose the wrong conversation option to not avoid it. And, like, maybe your health bar was already at a quarter at that point because you'd just done, like, a big fight and got to this new location, and this was just, you were getting the bit of information at the end of the journey, but then bandits walked in. And so you're starting this fight with a quarter of your health, and there is nothing good, sorry, about the combat system. Whatsoever. Like, no. I mean, I was, from what you're saying, it doesn't sound like this is going to happen, but I was kind of hoping that I was going to understand some part of it that I haven't yet, but it doesn't seem like it does a good enough job about telegraphing enemy attacks. It doesn't feel like Geralt's moveset is really equipped to deal with the speed or the movements of the enemies. Like, your dodges are either really clumsily too long in the way that they move you away from the enemies, and, like, it's a third-person game in which you have a turning circle, and so, like, getting close to things is just kind of slightly awkward at all times. And that kind of, that clumsiness carries over into the attacking, or it's just that you feel like you've moved out of the way of the Griffin's attack or whatever, or the sword swing, but somehow it still connects with you, and it does a huge amount of damage to you, but your sword swings do almost no damage whatsoever. I'm playing on, I think there's 4 difficulty levels, and I'm playing on whatever the normal one is, which is, so there's 2 difficulty levels harder than the one I'm on, and one that's easier.
Yeah, you're on the second one up.
Yeah.
You want to, like, try to just bump it down to the easiest one. Like, the combat system is just bad. It's, like, honestly, it's, so, you're right, you're totally right in the sense that Geralt just isn't equipped to deal with enemy attacks. Like, it's much more fun to fight humans because you can parry them. There's a parry move where you can just press the parry button.
Yeah.
You can't parry most monsters or creatures. You can block only some of them.
Yeah.
And all you have to attack them with is a lighter or strong attack. If you come up against a guy with a shield, there's no, like, shield break. There are, spells will knock them back but won't break the shield. And so you're just waiting for him to attack. And it's just, you always feel impotent. Like, you feel you're supposed to be a total swordmaster. And yet the combat system you have is so light on moves that like, compared to, like, there's not even a dash move. That long, dodge away move, like, I think one of the biggest problems with it is because there's no way to close back with the opponent that you're actually fighting.
Yeah.
So if you could do a long dodge move and then, like, a dash attack, like a Dante Devil May Cry 3 style dash attack, that'd be really satisfying because you'd have evaded and go bosh. And Siri has that move, like, she gets that later in the game. Yeah. Like, so a lot of the Siri, stuff.
Careful.
it's not as...
No, I mean, just because she's still listening.
Oh! Well, no offense, Siri, sorry. if you don't mind, Siri, continue to talk more.
She's not responding to that, but she responded to silly.
Yeah, strange.
Sorry, go on, Tom.
No, it's a tweak of accents.
She has strong opinions about Silly Bond.
Yeah. But, like, the weird thing about Siri is that, first of all, she's, like, an amazing character to play anyway. But all of the combat tweaks they make for her improve the combat system immensely. So her dodge is a teleport where she just shimmers sideways and she's invincible during that teleport. And that solves so many of the problems with dodging in that game where you just get hit irrespective of like whether you dodged or not. Like a lot of the Witcher 3, the problems are that you've made the correct decision, but now you've been punished for it. Because all of the monsters have different like hit lengths. And your moveset isn't calibrated to any of them.
Yeah.
That's really the central thing. Like, it just feels like they haven't thought about that at all. And it's odd after, coming after it, straight off Bloodborne, where that stuff is just absolutely minute calculated. And your sword strikes and your range and the enemy's range is always so precise and feels really mostly accurate when you're dodging. It's like, I don't know, the standards have gone up for that type of combat now.
It's even just like Batman, you know, I don't necessarily want every third person combat game to have me kind of slip sliding, teleporting towards enemies in order to make my punches land and that sort of stuff.
I do.
But there are, but like you'll get attacked by multiple enemies at a time and I swear that their sword swings are sometimes faster than my fast attacks are.
Yeah. Yeah,
and their ability, like, there are points where the game just says, no, you can't perform that move right now because you're in the middle of a different animation.
That's pretty correct, yeah.
And the enemies don't seem to have that, so even if they're in a stagger animation, then they can still sometimes instantly block in a way that I can't. And then I swear, I haven't played it enough yet to know for sure, but it feels like there are random dice rolls involved. Like, I mean, there's critical hit damage that happens sometimes, and I can't work out under what circumstances that critical hit damage does happen. But there are times as well where just, I will, like, use my, fire bolt sign, whatever it's called. And sometimes it does tiny little bit of damage, and they have, like, a bit of their clothing is on fire. And sometimes their entire body goes on fire, and they do a huge amount of damage. And I can't... doesn't seem to be based upon proximity.
No, that's a dice roll thing. There's also, critical hits as well. Like, strikes from behind do more damage, but there's also, like, critical hit thing that's built into your weapons that as part of the RPG stat upgrade system that you can maximise if you want to and stuff.
Okay.
But that stuff never meshes that well with a real-time combat system. And... I wish it was more of an Arkham, or like more closely a Shadow of Mordor system, where it was just, if Geralt presses attack, okay, so the reason why Batman's system is amazing is because Batman doesn't punch thin air. If you press punch as Batman, Batman as a fucking combat expert is gonna fucking punch someone. And that's how that system, it feels like that's the core tenet of that entire combat system is that Batman is never wrong. if Batman has pressed attack, he's going to fucking attack someone correctly. Maybe they'll block it, but he will hit them. He's not just going to fucking punch them there. And Geralt is a mutated fucking master monster hunter mega fighter. And the same rules would happily apply.
It took me like nine times to beat three fucking bandits in a pub. Because when it started off, I had like a third of my health because I wasn't expecting a fight. And then just I was in close encounters with dodge mechanics that didn't really work properly and a sword that didn't seem to do as much damage as my enemy's swords.
Unfortunately, once you level up a bit, there's a perk. Basically, the perks in the game seem to be devoted to fixing its own combat system. So one of the perks is reduce the amount of damage you take while dodging. So if you just power that up, then you take negligible damage.
Almost no dance damage.
So that helps the game enormously. So that feels fairer. And you can upgrade your spells to be actually useful. Like the Quen spell is the best spell in the game.
Okay.
The thing that casts a shield around you.
That's good to know. Because, like, so far, like, the balance for this stuff is that you can eat stuff during combat. So it's
Have some bread. Geralt
is the guy who's, like, getting his ass kicked by some poxy little bandits, but then he's eating some bread in the middle of the fight.
Yeah.
Hang on, I gotta have this baguette. No.
Yeah. But, like, there's so much in The Witcher 3's love that it's worth whacking it down to just, like, bang on easy level and just say, okay, combat is trivial, let's just enjoy the kind of...
I am really enjoying everything else.
It's like there's so much to love there. But yeah, you're right, the combat is shit.
That's all the questions we have anything to say about.
If you'd like to send us a question for a future podcast, you can do so by emailing us at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. Yes, I did almost forget the email address. What else do I say at this point? You can tweet us your questions at crateandcrowbar. You can also leave questions on the forum at crateandcrowbar.com/forum, which is also where you can discuss this episode. There'll be a thread there for that as well. Or you can follow us on Twitter as individuals. I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
I am at Gonnas, GONNAS.
I'm at PCG Ludo, as we know. And as an addendum, I'd like to thank Tom Francis for bringing the most excellent whiskey to this podcast.
which I've
enjoyed much of. Thank you, Tom.
Created a mini podcast about
It is Abelur.
Abelur's lovely.
You just drank most of it.
It's just confirmed what we already knew.
And I am Tom Francis.
It's the best whiskey. I'm telling you, it's the best.
My Twitter handle is at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
It's not the best.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Sorry. Oh, good whiskey.
I was fine until you mentioned the whiskey, and suddenly it had an effect.